Tonight we're going to be talking with four people, and we're going to be talking with Jim Harmon. Jim Harmon is a writer, broadcaster, and he's a special consultant on old-time radio to Hollywood Museum and the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Doubleday just came out with his book titled The Great Radio Heroes. I have a sponsor, Longines Symphonette, and they've got a tremendous album. Actually, six records in the album about the treasury of the old radio shows, the history of radio. Have you got it there?
This is the booklet that comes with the album, Golden Memories of Radio.
Oh, yeah, Golden Memories of Radio. And we've had a couple of the executives on with us from Longines Symphonette. And believe me, if you're thinking of a gift item, you ought to spring for that, for your own home as well as for friends and neighbors. Did you get one of these albums?
Yes, it's a terrific album.
Isn't it? Yeah. Absolutely.
And, right. They also did a one-record piece called Radio's Famous Theme Songs.
Well, I think that's a freebie. They give that to you if you go for the other thing.
Yeah.
Jim Harmon, what's the Hollywood Museum? I must admit that that's something I'm completely unfamiliar with.
Well, the Hollywood Museum is, I'm afraid, a thing of the past in more ways than one.
Like your book about the radio heroes of yesterday, right?
Well, it's not a thing of the past. It's coming on strong.
Okay.
But the Hollywood Museum was a plan to represent the movies and the two aspects of broadcasting, radio and television, to be a history of them. And they were going to build it in Hollywood, except that it doesn't seem to have happened, and it goes on, and I live in Hollywood most of the year, and I pass there, used to pass there, once a week or so at least, and they had this big billboard up, the future site of the Hollywood Museum, and it was up for about 5 years, and the other day I passed, and they'd even taken the billboard down, so it looks like it ain't going to happen. But while everybody was working and trying to get these exhibits together, I supplied recordings and artifacts and information and blood, sweat, and tears and helped out what I could. But the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation is still in operation, and I help them out from time to time.
Well, now, what are you doing at the present time? Anything as far as the history of radio? And the book, which incidentally is excellent.
Well, thank you very much. I have several other books that I'm talking with my publishers about. They're very happy with the sales of this book. They're so happy that they voluntarily gave me an advance today. And if you know publishers, that's like the end of the world when they give you money without even asking for it. And several of the books that I've got planned will be touching on various aspects of radio history, because that's my hobby. It's been my hobby for several years now.
Well, what have you been collecting?
Well,
tapes and
tapes.
Discs.
Mostly tapes. I have some of the transcriptions, and you know, I collect the old radio magazines and newspaper clippings about old-time performers, and I go around and do interviews with actors and producers on tape. That's sort of a form of collecting, I guess. I make up my own radio programs. And as a matter of fact, I had my own radio program in Hollywood for about 2 years, I guess. And I had one series in which I played parts of the old radio programs. And then I had another series in which I interviewed people who used to work in radio and associated subjects, you know.
Did you call it the Long Jim Show?
No, I think I always identify very strongly with a fat man, so I'd have to call it Fat Jim. The show in which I played parts of the old radio programs, which a program that I feel that the Longines Company particularly appreciated and must have taped off the air, that program was called Radio Rides Again. And the other program in which I interviewed people, that was called the Pop Art Review.
You mentioned about people that were formerly in radio. Now, I can understand that some people may retire. Some people pass away. But what is the reason that you have found? Is there a common reason why a very large percentage of people are no longer in radio?
Well, they're how many people are being paid to work on this show? I mean, this is your show, and you bring in guests, but you don't need actors, you don't need sound effects men, you don't need musicians. So radio today is generally one man working in a microphone. He's talking to other people, or he's talking to a telephone, or he's talking between records. And obviously, if you, you know, you maybe need, I don't know, 8, 12 men to run the average station, probably more for a big network mm-hmm. station like this. And so there aren't that many opportunities in radio anymore. The actors, they had to get out. I mean, there isn't any more radio drama. The only thing still in production that I know about is Heartbeat Theater, and that's produced by C.P. McGregor, and, you know, sponsored by the Salvation Army, and it's always somehow connected with the activities of the Salvation Army. It's kind of one long commercial for the Salvation Army.
Is this a network show?
No.
I'm unfamiliar with it.
It's syndicated, and it's usually carried
on... For free?
I think the Salvation Army pays.
Well, I mean, they would pay, but in other words... And then the local station uses it.
Uh-huh.
I mean, this is in the form of a question. To raise funds for the Salvation Army?
Now you're getting into the technical business aspects of the of it, and I don't really know. All I know is that C.P. McGregor, every week, he transcribes a new episode of this program, and he has the old actors there, and some way the Salvation Army manages to get it on the air. I know it's on the NBC station in Hollywood, in Los mm-hmm. Angeles, every Sunday night, and it's all over the country. And, of course, you know, who listens at the odd hours it comes on.
So what hours does it come on?
Well, it's usually, you know, some ungodly hour, like 6 in the morning, or occasionally it's on in the evening, but...
Any particular day at 6 in the morning?
It's usually on Sunday.
There's right in New York here, there's two or three very highly rated shows at 6 o'clock on a Sunday morning. They get tremendous.
Really?
Yeah, really.
Well, of course, New York is so
Yeah, I don't know anything about
so
Hollywood.
Many
I haven't
people,
been there
know.
For years, and for
yeah.
that matter, I only spent about a week or two there. So I wasn't even interested in radio at the time, so I have no knowledge of it. But right here in New York, the man, the man who makes the largest sum of money, I would say, in the entire country, but certainly in New York, this I can back up, in radio, and more than possibly the average fella makes in TV, and he's not syndicated, he does it on a local station, starts his show at 6 o'clock in the morning and makes really classical money, and including Sunday morning. Well, I'll tell you what, he, about 2 years ago, and this is the last figure that I have, which is about 2 years ago, and if anything, he's making more, not less, close to $750,000 a year.
Well, that's
and you could get by on that.
Yeah,
you know,
can,
I mean?
You know,
if you economize,
right.
and, you know, take it easy.
And if your wife's got a job too.
Well, she does all the mail and writes the letters, so
I
he
see.
Saves that way.
Yes.
You
yeah.
see what I mean?
Okay. Well, of course, his show starts at 6, and he probably
that's
is
true.
On for 3 or 4 hours.
He's on until 9 o'clock.
And the Heartbeat Theater is 25 minutes. And all I know is they must put it, you know, it varies from station to station, and they figure out what's the lowest listening, you know, what the lowest audience is, and then that's when they put it on, you know, really.
Well, let's just discuss that a moment.
Yeah.
And I've never heard this, so I'm not going to act as a critic, and even
if
I had heard it, I would not comment on the merits of the show. My question would be...
Yes.
Maybe they ought to do something to make the show better then, so that management of stations would put it on at a better time.
Well, it isn't a bad show. Now, maybe I'm putting it down too much. I don't know what its ratings are, but obviously the reaction here, I don't think anybody around this table has ever heard of this program, have they?
No, I haven't.
The only reason that I do is because, you know, I'm kind of a nut about old-time radio or about dramatic radio.
Well, why do you want to list it as old-time radio when it's current, you said? It's playing right now in Hollywood.
Well,
it's 6 o'clock Sunday morning.
That's, well, it's in Hollywood. In, I think it plays at 6 o'clock Sunday morning on a New Orleans station, to be specific. And in Hollywood, it plays at 7:30 at night, Sunday evenings.
That's not bad time.
No.
You can do pretty well at 7:30 on a Sunday night.
Well... It's not a badly done show, and the Salvation Army angle isn't hit too strongly. It's just worked into the story, and the stories are mysteries or are romantic programs, and they're about as well done as the average radio program, the average dramatic program of yesteryear.
My director just told me that the gentleman that I was referring to making $750,000 a year starting at 6 in the morning, that another station in town has, that he is employed by, has preempted him from 6 to 6:30 on a Sunday morning in using this very program that you're telling me about.
No, it's the Salvation Army, it's the Christophers. I was going to say that.
I don't know. Well, Howard Thayer, my director,
that must be
about 5 years now.
That must be another program, because this program I'm talking about, hosted by C.P. McGregor, it's called the Heartbeat Theater, and it's definitely for the Salvation Army.
Yes. It's a different program.
Ah.
We are wrong.
Oh,
you
well.
See that? You are right again.
Well, I'm often wrong, but, you know, I mean, I make mistakes. I make mistakes just like a real person. But,
really?
Yeah. But, anyway, this program doesn't seem to be a real smash hit anymore. I don't know.
The one that we're talking about is called Family Theater.
Family Theater is an old series that they rerun. It's no longer in production.
Oh, they're just replays.
They're just reruns, replays, right. But the Heartbeat Theater is done new. Maybe they do them in a bunch, but every program is a new program, and it's tied in with, you know, current events and so forth, and it is timely. And as far as I know, that it is the only program, dramatic radio program, currently in production.
Have you ever read Gene Shepherd?
I've often read, admired Mr. Shepherd. I've read his last book,
In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash.
Right, we did that in chorus. Yes, and I like it. I think it's a very good book.
Well, you know, he's a real, real fan of old-time radio.
I get it, then.
Yeah, and in fact, in the new book put out by, it's a compilation of many articles that have appeared in Playboy, and I think it's kind of an honor for Gene, because two of the articles in this new book of humor, which is sort of a gift item for the holiday season, and Tanya Grossinger sent a copy over to me, and two of the articles are by Shepherd. All the others are by individual well-known humorists, and both
he
of
has
the articles...
two.
Yeah, he has two in the one book.
Right, well, that's...
But he's really an expert on old-time radio. Let me ask you this. Of all the things that you've written about in your book, Jim, The Great Radio Heroes, what particular show carries the greatest interest for you?
I Love a Mystery. That was a program about Jack, Doc, and Reggie, and it was written and produced and directed by Carlton E. Morse. And, of course, I could list the radio cast. Most of them wouldn't be familiar to anyone except, you know, the more expert of your listeners and people that are more involved in this. One man, however, who played Reggie during the last few years that it was on, has gone on to greater fame. He was Tony Randall. And of course, he's very big in the movies these days. And of course, that wasn't the reason I liked it, really. I mean, Tony Randall's great in the part, but in case anybody listening in who has never heard that, and I suppose you must have listeners in their 20s and younger who might not have heard it, it's a program about sort of the three musketeers brought up to date. Jack, Doc, and Reggie were three adventurers, and they weren't interested in money. You know, they weren't private eyes as such. They weren't out to make a buck. They were just out to have a good time and hunt out mystery and thrills, and they were kind of rebels against society. They're the kind of people that would stay up all night and listen to Long John Neville on the radio instead of...
Obviously intelligent.
They were intelligent, individualistic people, and I dug that the most, and I've heard all of these programs since I collect them. I've heard them all recently, and I Love a Mystery stands up. it's not one of those things that's camp, you know, so bad that it's mm-hmm. funny. It's good today. And
you mean it could be reissued today?
If they were played today, they haven't dated. Well, the language, you know, the slang is dated a little, but the story values are still tops, and they would be great.
Well, I think we should find out what Mrs. B.T., Judy Teller, has to say about the Lone Ranger. She is our youngest participant tonight, and it is quite obvious, and all of our listeners know, that around March 25th, we will have Tiny. March 5th? Moved up 20 days, huh? We'll have...
You put a word in and...
No.
Make that phone call.
We'll have Tiny T, who will have no knowledge of any radio show except the Long John Neville show.
Well, he's on it tonight.
That's right. But you enjoyed the Lone Ranger, and I must say this to you, Jim Harmon, that one of those people that were very anxious to come on the show happened to be... our friend Judy Teller, because she read your book and was very excited about it.
She wants to tell me all the mistakes she found.
Well, I think I only found one.
Lone Ranger, what was the mistake?
Well...
You want the book, honey?
No, yeah. I have it. It's on page 207. Now, I'm not sure it's a mistake because I looked it up in... what is it? Great radio shows?
Golden Age of Radio.
Sorry, Golden Age of Radio, and they don't list it.
Uh-huh.
But... the lady who, together with Thunder Martin, took care of the silver mine.
Pardon me a moment. We're having a little difficulty. You're on mic, but Tiny T isn't. Go ahead.
But I was always under the impression that her name was Clarabelle Hornblow instead of Blower, which you have done. It's a picayune, ridiculous thing, and I may be wrong.
You may be right. I've never seen it spelled out in a script, and I'm uh-huh. going from memory and from recordings I have. And of course, it's hard to distinguish a name, you know, when they say it fast, whether it is Hornblower or Hornblow.
True.
You may be right, and if so, I stand corrected.
Well, it's only that as it's written, it's very campy, and I don't think they really intended it to go that far.
I see.
And, of course, if my memory serves me, because I used to follow that program as some people follow their favorite movie star. Or
right.
I think I began to listen when I was about 5, because that's when I was allowed to stay up as late as 7:45 if I were very lucky,
right.
Or 8 o'clock, which is when it was on in New York. But I had found one occupational hazard when I read your book. It brought back to me how much I had listened to the radio. It took it up a tremendous part of my life now that I look back on it. I rushed home from school, and I can name every program that was on from 2:30 until late at night in their order. I tried it. But I find that I'm completely unable, although I remember the characters, to remember any plots whatsoever, except, of course, the classic Lone Ranger plot, which they repeated once a year with the Cavendish gang and so
right.
on and so forth.
Yeah.
But that's one of the reasons that I was reluctant to talk about anything else besides the Lone Ranger, because aside from that one show, I don't remember any plots. I've listened to The Shadow, and I've listened to him in reruns. And it seems to me that I'm too young to have heard the really good shows of all of them. According to your book, all the good stuff happened before 1944 or 5 or 6.
That's certainly true. The Shadow is much better in the 30s,
mm-hmm.
even. It really went steadily downhill. I don't know that there's a great deal of difference, though, in the Lone Ranger.
Let's face it, that couldn't have been better than it was.
Well, right, and I have examples from, you know, like 32 when it started the first year, and then I have things from 38 and 39, and from the 40s and even from the 50s, and there is very little difference. It's all of a piece, so it was as good as it ever was when you heard it, in my opinion.
Well, of course, it's kind of disillusioning because I heard it and the Greenhorn and the Shadow in reruns.
Right.
And I can't believe I listened to it with such avid preoccupation because there really wasn't that much going on.
Well, of course, you were younger and your critical standards were
Quite.
It's sharply defined.
She's 42 now, so how long ago could that have been? You know.
She looks great for 42.
Thank you. I'm proud of it myself.
I thought she looks even great for 41.
Yeah. You're
my
kidding,
family.
Of course.
I never asked her. It's one of the personal things we've never discussed.
There's one more thing. There was one program whose plots are indelibly stamped on my mind, the only one.
What's that?
And that was a show whom no one else had ever heard of until last night when we were talking about your book with some people, and he had heard of it too. It was called Dimension X.
Oh, sure. That was science fiction series. Of course, I've been a science fiction writer since I was 13 years old, mm-hmm. So I remember that pretty well. And I never had a story. That program, Dimension X, was sponsored by Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine. And I've had like 50 stories in Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, but they never adapted any of my stories for that program. But once I was mentioned in a promo.
Do you know who's on this program at least once a week or once every 10 days? Fred Pohl.
Oh, Frederick Pohl.
Yeah,
well, he's
the editorial director of Galaxy Publications.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know Lester Del Rey?
I know him.
Lester Del Rey is on the show. And Blish.
Jim Blish.
And
right.
I'm trying to think of the fellow who started on the show here who's very successful today. He's doing movies and all.
Harlan Ellison.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If we talk much about Harlan Ellison, I'm going to leave.
All right. Howard, do you think we should... okay, I'm sorry. I thought that you wanted to at this very moment. Sandy.
Oh, Jim, getting back to the Lone Ranger for a second. There's a gentleman who's on the show from time to time named Robert Koshner. Robert Koshner is the editor of a leading news service, Newspaper Enterprise Association. And he also, periodically, I would say at least once every hour on the show, commits a grave error, in fact, because Bob is so sure of himself that he doesn't bother to check the facts. Now, he called me today, and he said he had read this book yesterday. I think the publicist at Doubleday had given it to him. And he said he found an error. I said, what's that? He said, well, who was the first Lone Ranger? I said, it was Brace Beamer.
It doesn't say that in my book.
No. And he said it was Fran Stryker. Who was it?
Well, according to Fran Stryker himself, the first man who played the Lone Ranger, and he played it for only 7 broadcasts, was a man named Deeds, D-E-E-D-S, and nobody, he must have been so bad they told him to get out of the station and not come back, because I don't really know, you know, maybe he was great, but anyway, nobody remembers his first name, and as far as I know, his first name has been lost in the dim red dawn of time. There is a first name given for him in another volume that I see the distinguished representative of the New York Times has with him, but I think that first name given to Mr. Deeds is just pulled out of thin air to make it look more complete or something. But
well,
nobody else, I mean, since nobody that worked on the show knows it, I don't know how they would find out his first name.
Well, no, I'm referring to a man who played it for a period of time. And,
the first man who played it for, well, the first man who played it for more than 7 broadcasts was George Seaton, the movie director now. He's called George Stennius then. And he played it for about 3 months. And then Beamer played it. He was the third man.
He was the station manager, wasn't he?
He was the station manager, and even before he played the part of the Lone Ranger, he had narrated the program.
Well, Mr. Koshner, and I'm sure he's checked this out, says he got his information from Mrs. Fran Stryker, who he met recently. Well, not recently, but
you
who
say,
he met.
You
yes.
say that Stryker, the writer, actually played the part of the Lone Ranger.
Evidently, Mr. Koshner claims that Mrs. Fran Stryker, Stryker's wife, did give him this information, yes.
According to Fran Stryker himself, according to Fran Stryker's himself in interviews a few years ago, the part that he played on the show in the early broadcast was the part of the Lone Ranger's brother, the elder Daniel Reed. This was the part he played. and that was the brother that was killed along with the, well, there were six Texas Rangers, as most everybody knows, who rode into Bryant's Gap. The Lone Ranger, who, as far as I know, his first name was never given. He was just the younger Reed brother. And his older brother, Daniel Reed, and Fran Stryker played that part, according to Fran Stryker himself. And I can easily see how, you know, his widow might be confused on this point. She's working from, you know, memory, and she might be a little confused on the point.
I would just like to say that Dimension X, the director, was Danny Sutter, who was
Daniel
here every
Sutter,
day.
Right.
He handles Monitor today. He's one of the producers for Monitor. Gentleman seated there behind the console is John Powers. He was in charge of sound for Dimension X. And Red Dubois, who is not here tonight, one of our engineers, was the engineer on the show.
Well, that was one of the last great radio dramas. That's a distinguished credit to have, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, this John Powers has been our engineer for some time, and he was the man in charge of all sound effects for Dimension X.
And they were very good sound effects, as opposed to some of those science
I don't know
shows.
Who did the work for him.
I see. Well, he picked out good men to do it.
All right.
Well, I was just going to point out that I think it's possible that people a little younger than 40 might enjoy the book, since the author of the book is 34.
Well, let me say this. You are very unusual, Mr. Harmon, because...
Everybody tells me that, yeah.
You're very unusual because the we have a young man who is 25 or 26 who is an expert on musical comedies, possibly knows more than anybody, not about any musical comedies that have been produced during the last 10 years, but prior to that.
Well, this wasn't research with me. It's mostly my memories.
You mean you heard all these shows?
I have heard every
I mean,
show
on the
virtually.
Air. I'm not talking about tapes or anything.
I've heard virtually every program that I mention in the book. I talk a little bit about, well, I talk for a sub-chapter about Little Orphan Annie, and I must admit that I never heard the classic series of Little Orphan Annie. I heard sort of the revamped series of Little Orphan Annie, in which she had a partner who was a great deal like Captain Midnight. He was called Captain Sparks, and that's the series of Little Orphan Annie I heard, and the earlier one that most people remember. I did have to research, but that's about the only example of the book in the book that I didn't personally hear. After all, you know, all of these shows lasted into the early 50s, really. They didn't disappear with television. The Lone Ranger was on until, about 1954, I think. Exact dates in the book, I don't remember it offhand. And all of these shows lasted certainly long enough for me to hear them in my teens, even. I guess I haven't heard a lot of them. Like everybody else, I haven't heard them for about 10 or 15 years.
Well, you should get up early and listen to some of them on the air now. Mr. Sloan.
Well, I'd like to say first, I enjoyed The Great Radio Heroes very much. I found it a fascinating book. I think anyone who even has some of the vaguest memories of old-time radio would enjoy it. My own interest in old-time radio goes back... quite a few years, but in a strong way, what made this a hobby of mine, although it's nowhere near as deep as it is with Jim, and I certainly don't have the facts or the background in it that he does, but what really got me interested in it in a large scale was about 3 years ago when I was filling in for the advertising columnist of the New York Times, who was on vacation, and I was filling in for a couple of weeks. And I had an idea to do an ad column about how radio advertising used to be so closely identified, the story, the show with a sponsor, as opposed to television advertising today, which is there is no real sponsor identification because of the expense of television advertising and so on, the fact that there are so many sponsors for each show. But in radio, there was this definite identification, and it was so valuable to the advertiser as well as to the show. Tom Mix was Ralston, and Jack Benny was Jell-O, and Charlie McCarthy and Edgar Bergen was Chasen Sanborn, and Little Orphan Annie was Ovaltine. And these things stand out in my mind today, as they do, I'm sure, in many other minds of people who heard these programs. Well, when I did that column, I got a tremendous response, both in telephone calls and in letters. Tremendous. Anytime you get more than 10 letters, it's tremendous on any one single article. And this, I got quite a flow of letters. And from that, I started getting involved in this thing. I tried to read whatever has been written on this subject. There have been some other books, none recently, and none of the type that Jim's was. I started to try and collect whatever recordings were made on this subject. And by the way, there are a number of recordings on this area.
There's one great series.
Yes,
the
one great one is the album of
Lon Jean's
right.
Yes,
one is not for sale. The one that I want to mention is not an album that's for sale to the public. As a matter of fact, most of the ones that I would mention are not for sale to the public. For example, the Katz Agency, which is a radio time sales
yes.
Agency, they did a limited pressing, I think, of about 200 records, 200 different records of old-time radio type thing, in which they were using it to try to sell the modern-day radio. You know, radio. The theme was radio is not dead, radio is still alive, et cetera, et cetera. I wasn't convinced, by the way. I mean, I thought the stuff that they had on their record was so much superior to so much of the stuff that's on the radio today. Even more recently, Dan Seymour, who's now the president of
J. Walter Thompson,
and he's the Dan Seymour who was Danny on Aunt Jenny's radio program years ago, and he was on many programs.
We the People, wasn't it?
He may have been on that. He was also on the Orson Welles. He was the announcer on the Orson Welles program, The War of the Worlds, which was the great, great Mercury. Theater series about the invasion of Mars. Well, he gave a speech just this month to a radio group, I was able to get a copy of the speech, and it was an interesting talk in which he started talking about the old-time radio and also giving the theme, well, radio is not dead, radio is still alive, and look how much greater, its sales are, etc. This is all true. There's no doubt about it. But I think for the aficionado of a story, of a plot, radio has changed. It just doesn't exist anymore. And perhaps some people might call it trivia, and some people might call it remembrances of something that just doesn't exist anymore. Why waste your time, and so on. But I don't feel that way. I feel that talking about these people and reading about them is of great interest. It sort of recaptures a little bit of our youth and makes us think back into. Perhaps happier times, perhaps different
mm-hmm.
times.
True.
I remember, for example, when I was sick and I had to stay home from school, the greatest fun of all was putting on the soap operas. And, you could be sick and stay home and listen to some of these soap operas and go back, and 6 months later, if you were sick again, you'd stay home, and it seemed that nothing had really advanced very much, you
mm-hmm.
know? Our Gal Sunday was still trying to save... Lord Henry Brinthrop, and Helen Trent was still trying to find romance over the age of 35, and maybe in retrospect we place too much emphasis on this. Perhaps I don't know, but to me this was great radio. This was great listening, and I think that radio had then. And probably does today to some extent still, something that television can never capture. It enabled you to use your imagination when you were listening to these stories. You saw Jack Armstrong in your own terms, and someone else saw him in his terms.
Mm.
And this even goes for the great comedy stars, although I suppose there were pictures of those people in the papers,
sure.
so not as much. But as far as, the mysteries, the soap operas, each one of us saw them in our own terms, and this is what made it so much fun. I remember my My eldest son, when he was 5 years old, he said to me, he says, Daddy, what did you do in the olden days when there was no television?
The olden days.
In the olden days, yeah. And
wait a minute, do you want a yes or no on it? That question of yours, it's been like 2 hours now.
Let me look at Dan's speech there, Mom, will you? Because I heard something. Did you hear it?
No, I just read it.
Did you read it?
No.
The way I read it, I called J. Walter Thompson because every year for the last 3 years, up until this year, they had been sponsoring a program on NBC called the Golden Age of Radio. It started with the 100th anniversary of Chase and Sanborn, and then the 101st, and then the 102nd anniversary, one each year starting in 1964.
That's the way anniversaries usually come.
Yeah, and then they made also demo recordings of these programs, a few limited pressings, and I happened to get copies of these recordings, and I called to ask if there was something then for this year, and they said no, but they sent me this copy of the speech. Jim, what I was curious about, you mentioned a lot about some of the writers of the soap opera, people like Carlton Morris and Phillips H. Lord,
right,
and so on. Did other than Carlton Morris and Phillips H. Lord, names I had heard of, the other names I had not heard of too much, did these people go on into other areas? I mean, did they go on into television writing or into motion pictures,
right,
or other areas?
Right. Well, Robert Hardy Andrews is also mentioned in the book. He was the first writer of Jack Armstrong and the first writer of Just Plain Bill, and he went on to be a very successful movie writer, and he made all kinds of money, and he's still making money, and he's written all sorts of books, bestsellers. He travels all over the world. He knows, as they say, the heads of state intimately, and he wrote a movie called If I Had a Million, which became the Millionaire television series. And he's certainly very successful. Mm-hmm. And many of the other writers for radio might not be household names, but they've certainly, you know, are very successful in television and movies today. E. Jack Newman used to write Sam Spade, and he's had several television series in which he not only wrote them, but he produced and directed them. And, I could list a lot of names that, as I say, they might not be household names, but they are successful.
But this
writers.
Was a good training ground, right, for other types of writing. I mean,
it was a way to do good writing, and I suppose good writing is a training ground for other things.
What I meant was when radio, when this type of radio serial died, were these people able to find other areas?
The writers, I suppose, survived much more easily than anybody else.
Yes, that's right.
Alfred Bester, who I don't know if he's ever been on this show or not.
No.
He's a very successful television writer. And
let me just interrupt you for a moment.
Sir.
Are you aware of the fact that in his speech he mentioned your book?
No, I didn't. But
a new book has just been published by Doubleday, The Great Radio Heroes. It was written by Jim Harmon, an old radio bug. Now, this is a 263-page song of love for those magic hours of yesterday.
He's writing good copy.
No.
It was given to the International Radio and Television Society.
Yes, it was.
So,
yeah.
Well,
go ahead, what were you going to say that? I'm sorry.
Oh, no.
I should interrupt.
Oh, I'm awfully sorry. I'm
Stanley,
sorry.
I guess I must have been listening to you on these programs.
Well, Alfred Bester is a top he's not only a top television writer, he's a top science fiction writer. And Fred Pohl has bought and published a lot of stories by him. But, you know, go on.
Now, Len, I just want to say that what you said before was true, most of it. But the part that was false, I think that you're going to be tomorrow when the grand jury indict you on what you said. No, I think that the part you made about the transistor and the superheterodyne, you know, were important if you can listen to a radio today with a cat's whisker. But let me ask Len one question. I know you're a little puzzled because it's early in the evening.
He does this sometimes, and you almost think it's making sense.
Please don't. Now, you're a guy. You write for one of the three top papers in New York. and have you ever written about, like Jim has, not possibly a book, but I know that, because we know you've written The Great Merchants, but have you ever written an article for The Times or for any other publication on radio? Aside from the advertising thing that you talked about.
No, Sandy, I haven't. I did 2 advertising columns over a period of 2 years on it, but it was mostly about advertising, radio advertising, the fact that they were closely identified with it.
Well, do you think someday you'd like to write a piece on, let's say, a particular show, maybe not something that's in the great radio heroes, but maybe something about one of the great comedy shows?
I possibly might. Actually, I would have liked to have written a book like The Great Radio Heroes. I think it's a terrific idea. And
yeah.
Well, you could always do it better.
Well, I'm sorry you thought of it first, Jim, but
wait a mere 20 years and they'll have forgotten my book.
Yeah.
Is this title, now, you gentlemen possibly would know this, so I was having a discussion with somebody yesterday here at the station, and somebody said you can copyright titles. Now, can somebody else come out next year with a book called The Great Radio Heroes?
Well, that wasn't my title, anyway, by the way. It was devised by Doubleday, and just between you and me and 300,000 or 400,000 listeners, I think they must have got the idea from Jules Pfeiffer's book, The Great Comic Book Heroes. Mm-hmm. My title was not, I guess, not as good as theirs. My title was simply Radioland, with a subtitle, The Thrilling Days of Yesteryear.
I must say that I'd like to know what Len feels about this book. I'm sure he'll tell us. But The Great Radio Heroes, I think it's a great title.
Well, I think we should mention it again, The Great Radio Heroes, because that's the one I want them to go out and ask for.
I think it's an excellent title.
And Len will do the one on Radioland next year.
Yes, I'm glad you gave me that idea, Jim. I think a title does a lot to sell a book. Certainly, it gets a lot of the interest in the book, and it gets people to look at the book or to even ask about the book who might not have done it otherwise. And I think this describes the book fully.
I'm not objecting to the title. You know, I think it is a good title. But it wasn't my own creation.
By the way, publishers do usually come up with titles, many of them, and if not most, for authors, and usually they're good titles because the publishers are very well experienced in titles that sell.
Well, what about your book, The Great Merchants, Len? Was that your title?
No, that was the publisher's.
What would your title have been?
I really hadn't thought of it, because Tom Mahoney and I wrote The Great Merchants, we really didn't have a title down pat at the time. We had things we were sort of considering, but nothing affirmative, nothing definite.
Well, John will recall that there was this George Thayer who wrote an excellent book about the conservatives and the people of the right and left of the political spectrum in this country, and it's called The Father Shores of Politics.
Father,
and it's a terrible
father.
Yeah,
F-A-R-T-H-E-R. Yes, very tough title. I think that George, I don't think he agrees. I don't think you could really call him a dyed-in-the-wool conservative, not to the extent of being a Bircher. Am I right?
I think that you're right. I think that
I would say he leans a little more to the left than a Bircher.
Well, I see him come in with his little bow and arrow, you know, in case there's an enemy attack. But he doesn't have guns like the Minutemen
really
or anything.
Really did a great job.
Doesn't he have a subtitle in that book?
Yeah, the title is lousy. That's the subtitle of the book.
It's called The Title is Lousy? I've seen that.
All right.
I hate to keep getting back to my favorite.
No, I think you brought up a point that we should discuss.
Which is?
Well, you know, the Lone Ranger's name.
That remains...
No, I think, you know, that's an interesting thing to discuss,
Well, according to the book by the...
Frank Buxton.
Yes, The Great Radio Heroes.
No, not my book.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Book.
I mean, The Golden Age of Radio.
My book is The Great Radio Heroes. That's R-A-D-I-O-H-E-R-O-E-S.
You couldn't do that without the book in front of you. You know that, Harmon. Now, come on.
I know, and I was reading it upside down, too.
No, Judy had a question. We were arguing last night about this, whether or not, as you claim it's true, that the Lone Ranger was Jewish. There's no evidence to prove this, and she feels that that he was not.
I could tell by his voice. There wasn't a shred of evidence.
Well, I know for a fact that the Lone Ranger wasn't a Catholic, because he had a close friend, the Padre, but he was always... The Padre, several occasions, would say something like, "My son, I hope that you won't mind my giving you spiritual advice, even though you aren't of my faith." So that narrows it down. He's got to be either Jewish or a Muslim or a Protestant or something. Yeah. So,
well,
the chances are as good that he was Jewish as anything.
There is one thing I'd love you to tell, and that is how you, probably alone among thousands of boys and girls, had the opportunity to meet Grace Beamer. Although you didn't take full advantage of it at the time.
Right. Well, we never said, according to this other apocryphal book, and according to your memory, the Lone Ranger had a first name, John. I don't say that he didn't have a first name, but I don't include it in my book because from my memory and my research, I can't find it. Now, maybe the compilers for this other book of cast lists in alphabetical order, maybe they found it, and maybe your memory on this point is better than mine.
Well, I was under the very strong impression that that was his name.
John Reed. Okay, that's just an omission from my book instead of an error, so it's okay. What else? Oh, about my knowing,
yes,
Beamer. Well, I met him a few times when I was a little kid, 5 or 6 years old.
I love
old.
The way you tell it in the book.
Yeah.
Well, that part that you tell, to me, reminds me of something else, and I know Judy wanted to ask you, and she hasn't got the nerve, and I will. What page is that on, that they list the when Fred Foy announced the beginning of the Lone Ranger?
Page 203.
Now, Jim, would you please read that? To me, this is the one bit of radio that I think all of us...
That's 203?
Right.
You knew that this was my act.
That's a great stick. I love that. I love to hear this, and
With his faithful Indian companion Tonto, the daring and resourceful mask rider of the plains led the fight for law and order in the early western United States. Nowhere in the pages of history can one find a greater champion of justice. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear. From out of the past come the thundering hoofbeats of the great horse Silver. The Lone Ranger rides again.
Well,
you didn't tell me that to go home.
I sort of underplayed it, but,
I think that's one of the great bits. John does that in the morning when he comes in. He does it every morning here on NBC.
Well, you should have heard the sound effects in the background. Actually, John was doing the horse's hoofs. I'm sorry, we should have had that. Come in for just a moment. Just do it. Come on in for a moment. Take the board. Come in a moment. Just do that last part there, and John will come in. This is John Powers, who did the actual sound effects. You want to do it? Where are you going to do it? Now, my chair here. Are you going to do it next to him? All right, ready? Go ahead.
Nowhere in the pages of history can one find a greater champion of justice. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear. From out of the past come the thundering hoofbeats of the great horse Silver. The Lone Ranger rides again.
Wonderful, John.
True master.
Good.
I'm still trying to get Jim to tell the story about...
Oh, well, when I was a little kid in Mount Carmel, Illinois, there was, my parents had a lot of friends, that I didn't know very well. They just dropped around from time to time. And there was one fellow that used to come around from time to time. And I always thought he was a doctor when I was a little kid. He was a tall, heavy-set man, and he was always impeccably dressed. He was, his shirts were always blindingly clean, And he just, somehow I thought he was a doctor. And they called him Marcus, and he'd gone to school with my mother. They were about the same age. And my father, who was much older than my mother, he knew him too. He was a relative of my father's. I didn't mention that in the book. As a matter of fact, I just found it out recently after I'd written the book. And he went, this this friend of the family, Marcus. He went hunting with my father a couple of times, and although Marcus was a pretty good shot, I remember one hunting trip, he didn't get any ducks, and he was a little chagrined about that. And I, of course, didn't enter into the family conversations very much when I was 5 or 6 years old, but they were talking about something, and somehow the Lone Ranger came up, the subject of the Lone Ranger came up, and my mother said, why, Jimmy, as she called me, Jimmy, you know, Marcus is the Lone Ranger. And, you know, I'd been put on about the Easter Bunny and Santa Claus, and I was supposed to think that this fellow in a business suit with rather thinning red hair, this was the Lone Ranger. And I didn't look convinced of this, and Marcus said something to the effect that let's forget about it and talk about something else. But later on, I found out that man really was the Lone Ranger. He was Marcus Brace Beamer. I don't know the exact derivation of his name. I guess his real name was Marcus Beamer, and the Brace he sort of invented, as you know, people in showbiz, they invent names like, or they somehow acquire names like Long John Neville or Brace Beamer. And of course, obviously, Brace Beamer is a play on Brace Beam, which is a good name for him, because he was certainly, if anyone ever gave the appearance of being sturdy and trustworthy, it was Brace Beamer. Although he,
do you mean Long John? You don't feel as sturdy and trustworthy? You're making an accusation of that sort on these public microphones, I guess.
Well, look, I got my check made out for those labels already.
Let me ask you one more thing. I can't understand how you could have mistaken that very individualistic voice.
Well,
of course, at age five,
just,
I imagine,
yeah,
you weren't that discerning.
I wasn't. I was a dumb kid. But you know, somehow. It just wasn't the same. People do sound differently in person than they do over the radio or over a telephone even. And I suppose I must have noticed that it was, you know, somewhat similar, but it was just...
Didn't he give you any silver bullets when he came to visit?
No, he wanted, he didn't want any... he was there on vacation. He was in his old town, and I imagine he had enough people on his neck, you know, and he just wanted to get away from it all there. And he, I suppose that was one of the big things with him, is to try to avoid being recognized.
Well, I imagine...
I know some people, like there's one fellow in Hollywood that I've appeared with. I can't tell you his name now, but he wears a hairpiece on television, and he does a local television show, and he wears his hairpiece. And when he goes out, he doesn't wear the hairpiece, and he speaks in a whisper, like he had a sore throat or something, and people don't recognize him, because you know the hair's gone and the voice. If he spoke full voice, they'd recognize him. He's not a world famous figure, but he's a local television.
Well, in the days of radio, I doubt if the situation was so acute, especially since they probably very rarely, if ever, published a picture of Brace Beamer in connection with the character he played. It would have ruined the whole thing.
Well, they did publish pictures of Brace Beamer. I've got one with me, as a matter of fact.
Without the mask?
Not without the mask, although there are pictures of him without the mask. But, he was so... He was, you know, if somebody's... You know, they could cause a riot by just, you know, saying, you know, there's the Lone Ranger. You
but
know,
with
all
red hair, who'd believe it?
Well,
everyone knows the Lone Ranger had wavy black hair.
Yeah, everybody does. But anyway, he wasn't anxious to publicize it. When he was off microphone, he wanted to practice anonymity, I guess. And anyway, that's my story, and I've stuck with it.
You know, two things just come up in the last few minutes, which I think is interesting in this field. One was the demonstration we had of the thundering hoofbeats of the great horse Silver, yeah. And the other was something that Judy just mentioned about, you know, with red hair. Who would believe a long ranger with red hair? I don't think there's anything as disappointing, or there wasn't, as a kid seeing his first radio show, going there in person.
I
remember when I went, and I was really shocked at the whole thing, because here I had built up in my own mind, I think the program, my first program was Casey Crime Photographer, and I had built up in my own mind what Casey looked like, what everyone else looked like, and to see these people, you know, they were just people, you know.
In business suits.
Yeah, in business suits, and, you know, bald with glasses, and not very dynamic looking or distinguished or anything at all. And then come the sound effects and everything that you would imagine, you know, the shots and anything at all, the slamming of doors and running water, all sorts of things that just, you see a man there moving around things on a table, and it just came as such a disappointment because of this great imagination you had built up.
Well, I never saw a radio, a dramatic radio broadcast when I was a kid. I guess, well, I've participated in a few for educational FM stations. That's my only experience, and I wasn't too... I was past the age of disillusion, but I'm a hardened, bitter old man on the wrong side of 40.
Well, a lot of people are on the wrong side, you know, visiting things here, too, because there's one thing in your book, though, that I got a big charge out of, a little anecdote about the sound effects in the Lone Ranger.
Yeah.
And was it George W. Trendle insisted that the sounds be accurate, and that if...
they were great sound effects.
Well, if Silver's hoofs were going on soft packed mud, it would be sort of a softer clop.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it were going on hard clay, you know, it would be very, very hard. And that you would, as you pointed out, you would have to...
And when he was running across an enamel top table...
Silver did that quite often. You would have to have also the heavy breathing of a rider and the chaps and the all the sounds. And you said one time it was so realistic, one time a character actor reading the script got carried away, a bit part. And he said, you know, you hear the hoofs coming down. He said, listen, I hear a white horse coming.
Right.
That was a beautiful bit.
Yeah. They, when they were riding along, they swung their arm. I know that much. I've talked to them, you know, to give the, you know, the... There was a little jar in their voice when they moved like that. It sounded like they were riding a horse, they thought, anyway.
Do you have a radio today at home?
Sure, I have several.
How many?
Well, now, in my home in Mount Carmel, Illinois, I've got one that works and two or three that don't. And in Los Angeles, I've got an AM radio only, and an FM radio only, and I've got a couple of transistors, so I...
Well, do you listen to them at all?
Yes, I listen to them. I have listened in Mount Carmel, Illinois. I've listened to Long John Neville, not too often, because the wind has to be right.
I know.
But I've heard him a few times. I don't listen to drama, except the aforementioned Heartbeat Theater.
Well, I can't figure... There's something I can't figure, because I'm not that...
Yeah.
Up on the geography of this, but I know that they regularly get Long John Neville in Keokuk, Iowa.
That's right.
And that they just did a big feature story in the Keokuk paper.
Well, all I know is where I'm at. The station doesn't come in every night. So
there's a man out in Cleveland, Ralph Kaufman.
Well,
Ralph
Kaufman, Cleveland is closer than Illinois. I mean, Ohio is closer than Illinois.
Well, Jack Eigen listens out of Chicago to the show. Now, I was born and raised in Chicago, and I know there's many people in different parts of Chicago who've never even heard the show. And they've been up late at night, too. But Eigen, wherever he lives, happens to pick up the show at night.
Well, maybe I can afford a better radio than I can. Maybe that...
No, I don't think it has anything to do with a better radio.
I don't know either, but I know that I've tried on some nights. I've heard you on with flying saucer people,
yes,
things like that, and then sometimes the signal would fade out, and I'd have to give up on it.
Well, that's the saucer people.
They're interfering.
They're interfering because they don't want the message to get out that far.
I see.
We don't want people out in Illinois to know what's happening here about the landings that are taking place here.
Well, I tell you, the people in Illinois don't know a whole lot anyway. So,
Mount Carmel, Illinois, eh?
Yes, Mount Carmel is the small town in Illinois that you've seen in every movie and read in every book, and those stereotyped people really exist. They're just like that. Don't ever doubt it.
Well, if you want to buy a great, if you want to buy a great radio, I would suggest some of the Japanese products. I know they make great radios and cameras, like the Sony that I had. I listened up in, when I was in Expo.
Yeah, Expo 67.
No, I heard your show.
Bob Franco.
Right.
There, yeah.
And
Bob Kochner, yes.
I heard the show. It was both on a Friday night and a Saturday night with a little $12 to $13 Sony. And then when I went to Miami, I picked it up down there, too. So I don't think it really, I think if you have a good radio, doesn't
well,
have to be expensive.
I know I picked this show up again, you know, when the weather was right and there was moisture in the air and everything. I picked it up on a little pocket 14 transistor. And
was it a Japanese radio?
That's a Japanese off-brand. It's not a Sony.
Got a good brand. Sure.
And so I picked it up.
You know, speaking about the Japanese things, Harry California. Boy, did I blank out on that. On Inner Sanctum, the fellow who did it.
Hi, Brown.
Paul McGrath?
No.
He lives up Raymond Edward Johnson.
You don't mean Arch Obler.
Arch Obler.
Because
Arch listens to this program in California. He lives in the Santa Monica Mountains, and he has some particular place that no one else has ever told me in the Santa Monica Mountains that they hear the show, and he hears it. It's, you know, something that no one can quite figure out. Incidentally, Jim Harmon's book is published by Doubleday, and the title of it is The Great Radio Heroes. See,
that's R-A-D-I-O.
That's right, R-A-D-I-O. How do you spell heroes? That's what's always thrown me. E, I think it is.
E-R-R-O-S-E?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes, that's it.
Yeah.
I don't know if over at Doubleday, whether they sent a copy to Ben Gross, but I'd like to have you make a note of it and send it to Ben Gross tomorrow with a little note.
Okay.
Ben Gross is the dean of radio and TV editors. He wrote the book I Looked and I Listened, which was published by Random House about 7 or 8 years ago. It's a great book, and I am sure that Ben would be just delighted to have your book, The Great Radio Heroes, as a part of his library. He's at the New York Daily News, 220 East 42nd Street.
Wow.
And will you be sure to get Doubleday to send a copy over to him?
I'll do that.
And I'm sure that, put a little note in there that Long John said to send it to him. And I know that Mrs. Gross, Kathleen Gross, will enjoy reading it too.
Okay.
And I know our listeners will enjoy reading it. We hope that you don't wait for Doubleday to send you one, but go out and spring for one at your local bookstore. Don't write me and ask me where do you buy it. You buy it at the bookstore.
How about these sound effects, you know, my writing the note, and just like, you know, just like radio.
That's right. That's right. Sandy.
It's all fake, of course.
One of the interesting things in your book was about Tom Mix.
Right.
The other night, a friend of mine has some tapes that he's collected. Leonard mentioned some private or a small pressing of a record before that the Katz Agency had done. This friend of mine has collected on tape various bits from great old radio shows. And he had the introduction. He had Curly Bradley, who played Tom Mix, singing the Ralston song. And one of the other things, I want to get back to that in a minute, but one of the other things he had, and I had forgotten this now, the answer man. And I think the answer man's name was Albert Mitchell.
That's true.
And the announcer got on and said, and now the answer man, Albert Mitchell. And the guy said, thank you. Would you read the first question, please? And the first question on this tape was, yes, here's one from a man in Woodside, New York. Is it true that Adolf Hitler's telephone number is still listed in the British Who's Who? And the answer is yes, Berlin 73162. And that just brought back a whole world at that Answer Man show. And then they played the Curly Bradley bit.
Yeah.
And then I had read your book, and I forgot. I remember Burley Mike Shaw, who was the sidekick to Tom Mix, but I...
From
did
about
not
1943 on.
That's about the time I started listening, that I can recall about that time, I think. I did not recall, though, the stereotype Negro character, Wash.
Well, he was in every show, right? Well, perhaps not every show, but he was a continuing character on that program until the final episode in 1950. And the show started in 1933. And I think Wash was probably in the first year or so. Of course, Wash was like most of the Negro stereotypes on radio, was not played by a Negro, but was played by a Caucasian named Forrest Lewis. And he was a very sympathetic character, really. He's the type that I'm sure that the NAACP and Corps and so forth would object to. But still, he certainly wasn't a hate symbol. He was very sympathetic, and he saved Tom's life, but I suppose he was sort of the Uncle Tom type.
He was a little, there was a little step and fetch it in him, too. He was two symbol, and then that you mentioned a number of times. For example, if Tom X and Burly Mike Shaw and Wash were being tortured by evil outlaws, Wash would be the one to pass out first, the kind of thing. Because, after all, he was a Negro, and this was part of it.
It was a part of the times.
Like Amos and Andy could not be done today.
Right.
You know.
Of course, I've been active in civil rights work for a long time, so I sort of have a very ambivalent feeling towards things like that. But there are a few amusing aspects to it. I remember Forrest Lewis told me that he quit that role in the 40s, and of course, the program of Tom X came from Chicago. And he moved out to Hollywood, and he was doing radio programs out there. But, you know, these people were his friends, and he had sort of an interest in the program that he had appeared on for years. So he tuned in the Tom X program from Chicago, and he was listening to this show, and there was Tom X, and he was talking to this character, and Lewis was sitting there, and he thought, that's a very bad actor. And this character had some sort of accent. He was trying to figure out, you know, what was he, you know, was he supposed to be Irish or Jewish or Swedish or Chinese? And then Tom said, "Now listen, Wash." And so Forrest Lewis, he moved back to Chicago and took that role over.
A beautiful story. I rather enjoyed reading about some of the little adventures. Some of these things, too, I remember, as Judy did, too, some of the scripts, some of the storylines in The Lone Ranger, some of The Green Hornet, and some of Tom Mix, as well as a couple of Jack Armstrong references here. Now, this covers a book, The Great Radio Heroes, covers essentially, at most, a 20-year period.
Well, the earliest program referred to in the book is 1928. It's and Amos and Andy broadcast.
Well, they weren't the heroes. In terms of your real hero shows, you started a little later than that. 31, I think.
Well, the earliest in the newspaper section, I refer to a 1930 broadcast of Front Page Headlines, which is fantastic.
Well, we would agree, though, Jim, that by 1950, although there might some continue for a couple of years, by 1950, TV was pretty much
it's
taking the place here.
You're right. The bulk of the book concerns a 20-year period, and there are some extensions in either direction that makes it cover perhaps a 30-year period.
Well, the only reason I'm...
most, 75 or 80% of the book is concerned with a 20-year period, right?
There's a reason for that I mention that, because now we've had about 20 years of TV.
Yeah.
And I...
And it keeps getting worse every year, doesn't
well,
it?
Well, I don't know. I think it's sort of a thing to do to knock it. No, I think there are some... We'll all agree that there's some magnificent things that the TV people
name
have
done. Name one.
Oh, I could talk to you about Project 20. I could talk to you about some of the things.
Death of a Salesman last season was tremendous. There have been a few, you know, really good dramas.
The interview on the Leonard Sloan book, The Great Merchants, was done on Channel 13 once. The things of that sort. The reason I'm mentioning it is that I think that that next year you don't have to worry that some guy's going to come out with the great TV heroes and it's going to have this kind of popularity, because looking back now, I don't think that there's any single TV show on a series, on a continuing series, like a Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, or whatever some of the westerns were, like Wyatt Earp, or any of those things, that kids, who may be adults today, or the young adults today, could look back and say, with nostalgia, gee, I remember that show, this is what happened, and that is what happened. And
I think there are... A few. I mean, I'm sort of fighting myself here, but I think there are a few.
I think you're right. How about some
space
of the...
Space Cadet, Space Patrol, Captain Video.
No, I'm talking about... You see, my point is this. You take a Tom Mix or a... No, take a Lone Ranger. I think we're all familiar with that. One episode... No, the point is that one episode on the Lone Ranger where, let's say, the famous episode where the beginning, where Butch Cavendish, the explanation of how the Lone Ranger came to be the Lone Ranger. And by the way, for years, until I could read, which was about when I was 18 or 19... I thought it said the long, and it was in the Long Ranger
there
for some reason.
There wasn't a kid on my block.
Everybody
didn't
said
think the same thing.
That's the Long Island Railroad.
Right, the Long Island.
And the guy who, the announcer, was just merely mispronouncing it,
right.
But we really knew what it was.
It's like saying, we used to take the word Spalding balls would be Spalding.
Spalding, yeah.
In New York. But the point is this, I could remember a particular, a number of particular half-hour episodes in fairly vivid detail. Whereas I think if you take one of the Space Cadet shows, you might remember the show on TV, but to remember a number of particular half-hour shows in that series,
mm-hmm.
I think you lose that. I think primarily
right.
is because I knew what the Lone Ranger looked like, and my idea of what he looked like and yours were completely different. And I had to work mentally to listen to a radio show. We all had to create our own pictures of how high the mountain was, or what Tom Mix looked like, or how fast Silver was going. And I think by working at it,
he was going as fast as the speed of light,
which was something that I didn't think in terms of 186,000 miles a second.
No, you didn't.
You see,
Sandy, I would have to disagree with you on that. While I don't think there are as many identifications with particular episodes in television as there are in radio, I think that there have been, in say in this 19 or 20 years of television, some series with episodes we can remember. For example, I Love Lucy, which for many years was the top-rated show. The series where her baby was born, on the air, she arranged to have her baby born by cesarean the same day that the show ran on the air about the baby being born, and the whole country was waiting for Lucy's baby to be born.
Wait a minute. The point
I do remember that.
First of all, Lenny, you're talking in terms of a guy who was not a little kid at the time.
Exactly. How much older were you then?
You
and
see,
how much better?
Well, I think so.
That
there probably were a lot of 10 and 12 and 13-year-old kids.
Who knew what cesareans were?
No, who knew that Lucy was going to have a baby.
Well, I
watched the show.
I think, to bring in a cliche, I think, though, these are the exceptions that prove the rule, that test the rule, because you can point these things out, but I can remember many episodes of many different programs, and I'm sure everybody here can, of radio. I mean, there are hundreds, if not thousands, if I sat down and wrote a book about them, that I could probably bring to mind. I don't know. You can find examples like The Birth of Lucy's Baby, which I do remember.
Some of the Sergeant Bilko episodes.
Yeah.
Also,
there's another thing about those episodes, you can still see them running at midnight or something.
No, not only that, I think I can... let's take Sergeant Bilko. To me, that was one of the great TV shows, one of the best written and best formats. But, frankly, maybe it's just me, but I had difficulty remembering a complete plot. I certainly remember a scene in a Sergeant Bilko where they accidentally induct a chimpanzee into the army. And there's a classic scene where... You know, you go through the psychiatrist and you go through the heart specialist that listens to a stethoscope.
Somehow the scenes of radio had a more heroic stature, though.
Oh, well, there's one scene, though, this chimpanzee scene, that's, to me, is a classic, but it's one scene. It's where the podiatrist is called, and the army podiatrist, and he examines your feet as you walk by, and he only looks at feet, you know, and bare feet, and suddenly there are these hairy feet, which doesn't faze him, and the fact that he doesn't get phased is a classic bit, but it's not a plot. And I name one.
That's really a psych, yeah.
One episode from one continuing series, and I don't mean something like a Project 90 or something of that, you know, whatever, Playhouse 90. Some thing like a half-hour film or an hour film series.
Well, you could do it, but think of how many more things you can remember from radio.
I agree that there are more in radio. Well, all I was trying to say is that there are, and there have been, certain memorable series or certain shows. Perhaps some of the Playhouse 90 shows.
Well, I can remember a lot of shows.
But that's so different.
But that isn't television. That was good.
That was theater on TV.
That they couldn't put up with that. They got rid of that right away.
I mean, who could forget sitting alone or lying in bed late at night And after a very eerie introduction, the story starts. The last man on Earth was sitting alone in his room when suddenly there was a knock at the door.
Yeah. Ew, I mean, it was...
Knock by Frederick Brown on Dimension X.
You know, Jim, one of the chapters that I enjoyed the most in The Great Radio Heroes was the one called Gentlemen of the Press, and that's probably because I am involved in newspaper work.
You're a gentleman of the press.
At least I hope
you're a gentleman.
I didn't mean that. Anything was just to say.
I thought it was quite interesting how the press people were all superheroes then, too, in a sense. Britt Reed, of course, who was the great publisher, who was the Green Hornet, and Steve Wilson, the editor of the Illustrated Press, Casey Crime Photographer, Front Page Farrell. They're all, great people.
Even Clark Kent, Superman.
Yeah, with no, you know, no flaws. Everything that they did was perfect. The police would bend over backwards, you know, to help them. Girls would go rushing into their arms. The bars they would attend would be the friendly little places that are almost in dreamland. I had a feeling that this was, you know, it, looking at it now, it was so unreal.
I think
then I didn't feel that, of course.
I think even then we realized that newspaper men weren't perfect, because after all, newspaper men were the only heroes on radio that were allowed to drink. I mean, you know.
I wonder where that came from.
I don't know, but, you know, they were the only ones that frequented bars, and while they never, you know, they never accepted it, as I recall, you know, people like Casey Crime Photographer and, I don't mean this seriously, you know, but I mean, they were offered bribes, and people thought they were a little shady or something, and, you know, they were, I think actually that... the puritanical standards of our society perhaps have a somewhat flawed picture of newspaper men in general.
Yes, and then there was the series that you also mentioned, The Big Story, and these were supposed to be real live stories.
Real, true people, and of course they had to be very careful with that.
Yes. Well, they were all people, I mean, the people were true. I had a feeling listening to them that some of the stories were sort of dressed up a little bit, you know, in which they tell the story of how this reporter got his story, and you know, everything had a natural beginning and a natural end. And
you mean stories don't happen like that in real life?
They do at the New York Times.
Oh, I don't know. I don't think so.
What about
speaking of dressing up? How about the newspaper reporter, this fellow who dressed up like a girl to catch the sex maniac?
Well, the police do that today.
Well. Anybody works on the New York Times, do they?
I must say one thing, and Leonard, this is not a reflection on newspaper people, but for anybody who has not been in the city room of a newspaper, and a lot of people have not, I can't understand, that's a compliment actually, how you people can work in a room, for example, the size of a Times, it's like a football field. It's about that size.
Yes.
And you're there, yeah. And there are 10 guys on, you know, on either side of you, and there are 1,000 people in the whole room. And they're all typing, and
the desks are all lined up side by side,
and
the phones
are
ringing,
copy boy, and all that.
You mean the financial editor? You do have a private office, don't you?
Well, I'm not the financial editor, and I'm a financial reporter. The financial editor does not have a private office. None of the editors have a private office. The only one who does, except one, is the managing editor has a private office. But all of the assistant managing editors, the national news editor, the foreign editor, the sports editor, are all out in this room. The advantage they have, perhaps, is there may be 10 feet between themselves and the nearest desk, whereas the reporters have them lined up side by side.
Well, in Los Angeles, even the TV columnist has a private office.
Well, that's, L.A. is kind of strange in many ways. Is there any glamour? No, this is a legit question now. Leonard, you've been in... How long has it been since you've been working for newspapers?
About 11 years.
All right. Seriously, is there any glamour, as it was epitomized by some of the shows that Jim mentioned in his book, is there any glamour in the newspaper business?
I think that there is a glamour in the newspaper business still. I don't think it's the type of glamour that was evidenced by the characters like Steve Wilson and Casey on the radio. But there is a certain type of glamour in newspaper work still, with all the sarcasm and the feeling, you know, well, gee whiz, that some people seem to have as another job, and then the skepticism. There's really nothing like the daily deadline pressure, the knowing that you've got to get the story out by a certain time. There's nothing like, you know, the feeling you see when you have a story under your own byline, and this could be in a newspaper or a magazine. The knowledge that you know you go in each day with trying to come up with some sort of a story, hoping to get a story that somebody else doesn't have if possible. I think there's a lot to it still, and there always will be. But it's not a superhero business. Newspaper men are not heroes, really. They've got their flaws. They've got their problems, just like everybody else does. Maybe they have different types of problems, but
well, a hero is a concept rather than a real human being.
It's not the Shakespearean hero, the ancient Greek hero. You know, the person possibly with one tragic flaw. Newspaper people are people just like they are in any other walk of life. I think, though, that one thing about newspaper people, that it's one of the few industries in which the nonconformist still is around. There are plenty of nonconformists in the newspaper business, more so, I think, than just about any other industry.
Except show business, possibly.
Possibly, yes.
Or except among freelance writers.
It's not, you know, people dress however they want. It's none of the pressures of, you know, you've got to be the dark suit with the white shirt, as in some companies. There's a lot of people in the newspaper business who are different personality habits, possibly, that might not be accepted elsewhere. But basically, it's can you produce? And you know, it's how you... Can you write? Can you write under pressure? Can you go out and find a story? Can you talk to people? Can you dig out information? Can you research information?
One of the things I got to ask you is this: why do so many people, and why do so many guys and girls stay in the business when it's really so notoriously underpaid?
That's a great question.
No, really,
I don't know the answer. There was a somebody cut out a piece that was in the Newspaper Guild newspaper and put it on our bulletin board about a week or so ago, and it was a speech, I believe, that one publisher had given to a group of publishers, and in which this publisher said that newspaper people aren't that much interested in money. They're interested in ego. Give them ego satisfaction, and you don't have to worry about the money. Well, you know, we can laugh at this, as we all did in the office, but obviously there's something to that. I mean, you do get a certain amount of ego gratification. Now, that's not going to help you when it comes to time to pay the rent or pay off the mortgage or buy groceries for your family. But I think a lot of people stay in the newspaper business because the satisfaction they get out of working on stories and doing it. Now, I know many reporters on the New York Times and probably on every other newspaper have had the job offers in other fields. Many have accepted the job offers, obviously, as from the attrition rate on newspapers. Yet many, many have not, and many very fine reporters just feel that... All right, so perhaps they're making a little bit less. They'll make do. Maybe they'll moonlight a little bit. But the satisfaction they get out of writing a story, which they feel possibly they can get in any other way, is worth it.
Well, I was going to say that it seems to me that, you know, that ego gratification is sort of a semantically loaded term. It has a sort of a negative connotation, but I think... it's not so much that many newspaper people who I know, they aren't interested in building up their ego so much as getting creative satisfaction, which I think is another term that you use, but perhaps not as prominently as the other term. And, well, the world would be a terrible place if people weren't interested in... having creative satisfaction.
Oh, certainly, and I think I think they're similar, and in maybe some cases they're used interchangeably, because it's you build up your ego by creating. in a sense.
One of the things that Leonard asked me to mention before the show, and this is all those listening who want to reward him, I think, for his devotion to newspaper work, to journalism, they might want to go out and buy The Great Merchants, his book, which that possibly will be a direct reflection of the gratitude they feel.
I think everybody should go out and buy every book that they can find that whose title begins The Great.
Not every, there possibly, you might be in trouble.
Well, we've got The Great Gatsby on our side. So.
Well, that's a good book.
Yeah. And you got Jules Feiffer.
And The Great Comic Book Heroes, and The Great Merchants, and that's MERCHANTS.
How come no pictures in here, Jim?
Oh, you're going to mention that?
Well, it's a dirty book. I know you have the but I'm not going to read that those passages. But how come there are no pictures in the book?
Talk about it with Doubleday.
I'm not going to ask Doubleday. You know, you're sitting here right now. It's
These pictures that I have with me, I wanted Doubleday to use in the book, and they said that, I'm sort of washing dirty linen in public, but you're asking me, and I'll tell you. Mm-hmm. They said it would raise the price of the book $1 if they had a picture section, and they felt it would sell more copies if it would cost that dollar less.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would have been a good idea to have the pictures, and I'm working on another book for Doubleday, and it will have a large picture section in it, including some pictures from radio. But this particular book does not have any pictures in it, except the picture of the Gothic-style radio on the cover with those three characters who are somewhat vague, but in my personal opinion, they represent the Shadow, the Lone Ranger, and Little Orphan Annie.
I knew it, Jim, as soon as I saw it. I don't think they're vague at all.
You know, Leonard, to me, I was quite amazed. I mean, I know every guy has some kind of hang-up, but I think radio is really your hang-up, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Probably, I guess, the one real hang-up I have, all-time radio. And,
you know, I'm amazed that you never thought of trying to book on it.
I guess I just never really had the time. I had projects... I was working on The Great Merchants. I'm working on another book now. And
what's it about?
On supermarkets.
Mm.
I'm working on a textbook.
A little zing?
Pardon me?
A little zing in it, or is it all...
No, it's pretty much
clothing.
Of a straightforward
beautiful,
textbook.
Beautiful We Care book.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I should have thought of it, but I didn't, and that's why I give Jim a lot of credit on it. Jim, there was something that struck me in reading your book and in previous readings about the whole subject of old-time radio. I have the feeling there's somewhat of a similarity between the old-time radio and the comic books that we grew up on. Now, let me try and elaborate that. I don't mean that it was the same type of stories necessarily. I just mean that these were the things that we grew up on. I think there are now cults. I don't think you and I are alone in this, in our feeling about old-time radio. Obviously not from the way your book is doing. And I think there are cults also about the comic books, the old-time comic books. And, I also once did an article for the Times about the market in old-time comic books and how some of the 1939 Captain Marvel and Superman and action comics are selling for fantastic prices now. If I only had saved some of these books and not given it away in the war the war drives during World War II.
Of course, if everybody's saved them, they wouldn't be worth anything.
Obviously.
It's the rarity that makes them
right.
valuable.
And there are clubs of comic book collectors, and there is a magazine, at least one I know of, I can't remember the name, for these clubs of comic book collectors. They have a convention once a year here in New York. I remember speaking to the man who was the president of this organization. And I noticed in your book, I believe it was in the introduction, it mentioned that you have a magazine called Radio Hero Magazine. Could you tell us a little bit about that? Because it sounded interesting.
Right.
If it's what I think it is.
Well, Radio Hero Magazine is sort of in suspended animation at the moment, but I did put out several issues. Of course, as I mentioned before, I am a professional writer, and most of the time people pay me for what I write. But at the time that I brought out Radio Hero Magazine, this was before I could convince any publisher that there was a good market for this type of book for a professional audience. So I published my own little magazine, and it was, well, it was just mimeographed, like an old radio script, I guess. And I wrote some of the articles, and I had some friends of mine, mostly fellow writers, to write up all that they could remember about some particular program. Incidentally, I found that everybody has one article in them called "I Used to Listen to," and then I heard, but that sort of thing. It just goes so far. I mean, they all sound alike, you know. Every Sunday evening, I heard Jack Benny. And then a little later on, I heard Fred Allen, you know, and they were certainly great. So I tried to get people to write about one particular program, all that they could remember about one particular program. And some of that information I have, with permission, used in The Great Radio Heroes. And this publication saw 3 issues, and I think it was one of the few mimeographed pamphlets to get a full-page story about it in Life magazine. Very few mimeographed pamphlets are reviewed at that length in Life magazine. But it was, and I was contacted by Jeremy Tarcher, who is a book producer. He produces books that are released by publishing companies like Doubleday. And he and I worked very closely on this book. He's a very brilliant editor, and many of the ideas were his, although the actual writing is mine. And so
developed, I see, out of the... Could you elaborate?
And then I wrote.
Yeah. Could you elaborate on what a book producer does? Is this sort of what a record producer does? He tries to bring the company together with the artist, or with the writer, or with the composer.
Yeah, that's about the size of it. I don't know all the intricacies of the operation. There was a story about Mr. Tarcher in the Hollywood Reporter, which probably, I guess, is on sale out here.
No.
It isn't?
No.
I've never. Just Variety,
it.
I guess.
It is. Variety, yeah.
Yeah.
It's not on sale. You can get it if you subscribe to it.
Right. Well, it's a competitor to Variety. And it looks practically the same. You can hardly tell them apart. And they sound alike, too. But there was an article on what he does, and he has various arrangements. Sometimes he's more intimately involved than others. On some of the books, he just does everything. He has them printed. He goes to the printer, and he goes to the binder, and then he delivers them to the warehouse, and the publisher takes it from there.
Sort of a Bernard Guy.
Yes, similar.
No. No, I would say that the closest thing that he would come to, the closest person that he would come to would be Stuart Daniels. See, Bernard Geis was an editor for Prentice Hall. And he, in turn, was bankrolled by a number of people. And rather than attempting to set up his own distribution company, he made a deal with Bennett Cerf, Random House. And there was a little disenchantment in that love affair.
Just a few weeks
now he
ago.
Has, yeah, and now he has Crown distributing the books.
Mm-hmm.
But he actually, you can consider him in the publishing business. He is not a finder, per
yes,
se.
That's right.
Whereas Stuart Daniels, who was vice president of Prentice Hall for a number of years, first he was in charge of public relations for Prentice Hall back in 60 or 61, and then he became vice president of Prentice Hall, and I think his last book for Prentice Hall was the Arlene Dahl book, and then he went out on his own and was sort of out scouting around. He would have an idea and would search out a guy who could execute the idea. Incidentally, and Stuart Daniels happened to be a very competent writer himself, so he set up his own organization, which he now calls Stuart Daniel Publishing.
That's
Isn't that the technical
that's
name?
That's it, yes.
And he is working through Hawthorne. And Hawthorne used to be a branch of Prentice Hall at one time. And now Hawthorne was purchased by a multimillionaire who about 20 years ago was kind of despondent and figured that there was nothing in life for him until one day he was inspired by some philosophical discussion and became one of the wealthiest insurance men in the entire nation and bought Hawthorne Books, and he has an associate of his, Stuart Daniels. Now, books that will come out will be Stuart Daniels' books, but they will be distributed by Hawthorne, and Hawthorne have done a pretty good job. And I think that Stuart Daniels, you might say, doing the same thing as that your man,
Jeremy Tarcher,
yeah, is doing.
Yeah, Stuart is, for example, I had a chance to see him a few weeks ago, and he mentioned that he's also, since he's got the background in as John mentioned, in public relations and editing and the management, that he will be in a position to get involved in editing and writing all of the parts of a book. It's quite a different thing from a Bernard Geis, I think.
Yeah, this is not to discredit Geis or anything like that, because Geis has done very well, but it's a little different operation, and I think the real similarity would be the one of the man who has been working with Jim.
It was a tragic story about Masters of a sort in the New York Times yesterday. I shouldn't say tragic, but it was kind of a poignant thing. A Jane Russell picture, motion picture, that had been produced at a cost of $500,000. And I don't think it had been released.
No, it has not been released yet.
This picture, there was an auction. There was a lien against somebody, and it was auctioned off. And the first bidder got it for $1,000.
I'm amazed to hear that there is an auction sale where one bid constitutes a legal bona fide sale. It's usually two or more bids before you have an auction sale, which means competitive bidding. But however, we'll assume that maybe Mr. X bid the first offer of, say, $950 in the second bid.
That possibly happened. It was, some of these people have a very, very low voice. They speak very softly.
That's right.
I might not have heard it.
In fact, I think we have, thank you. The gentleman over here just bid $1,100.
A little late now, but maybe.
Actually, this was one of the companies that to which the producers owed quite a bit of money, considerably more than $1,000, and so this is merely to protect their interest. And now,
well, can they use it now?
Oh, yes. Now he's going to try and sell it to the distributor. And try and sell the picture.
Well, he can't miss that. He'll sell it to some TV network, right?
And he's got to make money.
I don't know. I didn't.
He's got to make it.
Yeah.
In fact, I'll buy a piece of his action. I'll buy half of it for $750, and I haven't even seen it.
Well, say.
Show you where I am, huh?
Yeah.
How do you put that about speculation?
That's right. You must speculate to accumulate.
Yeah, but I wonder who would put, $500,000 into a picture starring Jane Russell,
Oh, Howard.
He did 20 years ago, but, Jane's a nice girl, but...
the picture was just recently made?
Fairly recent.
Yes. No, this is an unreleased picture.
It's called Magnificent Frauds.
I have had some experience with the people who make Z pictures in Hollywood, and I don't see how anybody could possibly be any more stupid than these people. And
why do you say stupid?
Well, because it's a good word to describe them. They don't make any money.
I think I know what the word means, but I can't understand why you say stupid, though.
Well, if you disagree with me, well, tell me why.
Well, go ahead. You continue, and then I'll try to get involved with you in a discussion on it in a moment.
Okay.
What makes them stupid, as far as you're concerned?
They make bad pictures, and they never make any money. I'm talking about the very lowest budget people.
I thought you meant Hollywood in general.
Right? I wrote an article, and I called it the old underground movie makers. There's the new underground, which I think works in New York, and they make art pictures, and they make them on the streets of New York. And of course, these are underground films. But there's another group of people, and they're mostly in Hollywood. And I guess they have the same kind of love for old pictures. Not the good pictures. They like the bad old pictures. They have the same kind of love that I have for radio.
I must disagree with you. Now, this is an area that I've done quite a bit of studying recently.
Well, I think also we should mention, because some people are unaware of it, that
And I'm not going to say that his pictures are Z pictures, but because I think they're excellent, in fact. Sandy does a lot of work, and what encouraged him, because Sandy at one time was working with Norman Lipton, who is the head of the West German camera industry in the States here. In other words, representing all the manufacturers.
Promotion.
And you were in charge of promotion.
And publicity. Yeah.
Publicity for them. And when Super 8 film came out, not Double 8, but Super 8 came out, he bought a camera and became encouraged about the fact that this was a little larger frame, not quite 16, but a little larger frame.
It's about 50% larger than...
Yeah. And Sandy has done some excellent work that has not been shown to the general public, but has been shown to people who have a knowledge. In fact, I'm hoping to get in touch with Ruben Mamoulian, the great director, mm-hmm. who I think, I may be wrong, might be keenly interested in some of the work that he has done with a Yashica motion picture camera using Super Double 8. And that's why Sandy, I know, disagrees.
Great, but can I... Look, I've
go
got
ahead.
To define
yeah.
what the kind of film I'm talking about.
Mine is not commercial, I'll tell you, at the moment.
Right, I'm not talking... These are films that you've probably never seen because they play almost nowhere. I'm not talking about art films. These are anti-art films, if they're anything. But there's a whole group in Hollywood that makes this type of film. And you don't know about them because they don't get publicity like the people who make art films, like Sandy. Or Ed Emishweller. He makes... science fiction illustrator. He's illustrated some of my stories.
Or Brackett, just people of that sort.
Right. Now, I'm not talking about these people. I'm talking about this group that you probably don't know about. And they in 1967, they're making dead-end kids' pictures.
Oh, wait, there. I got you now. I got you in 2 points, I think.
Right.
Number one, there's a gentleman that was given a front page, the major feature story in the Wall Street Journal a month ago, named A.C. Lyles.
Those are B pictures. They're not the kind of film I'm talking
they're
about.
They're westerns, mostly with Richard
right,
Arlen.
Right.
They make fortunes for Paramount that distributes them.
I know A.C. Lyles.
Right.
I know, I can't think. Alex Gordon.
Right.
He makes those kind of films.
Number two. Now, this, I'm not that up to date about it, but some ten years ago, I spent a few months working for Allied Artists. Now, they used to produce the Bowery Boys films.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't the rabbi, wasn't he associated with them?
No, the rabbi was American International.
Oh, American
he
International.
He did his
yeah.
rabbinical duty, whatever he did with them.
Yeah.
With American. Allied
That's
artists.
It's been a successful outfit.
Yes, it has.
Fortune.
Oh, the teenage pictures.
Yeah.
But the Bowery Boys pictures were the mainstay. At the same time, they were putting out pictures like Friendly Persuasion with Gary Cooper. And Love in the Afternoon with Gary Cooper. But at the same time they were doing that, they were still turning out the Bowery Boys films, and there were parts of this country, even with the heyday of TV had arrived, that people would line up for blocks, or a block, let's say, like you do here across the street at Radio City for a big film, to get in to see a Bowery Boys picture, mostly in the South. And that was the mainstay of the company for many years. So unless you're in a position, Jim, to judge whether these people are making money when you talk about dead-end kids or Bowery Boys, they may be making money.
Well, I was on the inside. I worked with these people for most of a year doing other things, so I know how much money they were making. And I still don't think that you quite appreciated the depths of the business that I'm talking about.
You're talking about nudies now, are you? Because they make money.
No, these are made about on the same budget level as a nudie, but they aren't nudies. The pictures that A.C. Lyles makes are, you know, like Gone with the Wind compared to them. But there's this whole group of people. And, you know, I know about the Bowery Boys. The last Bowery Boy picture was in 1958. Leo Gorcy had dropped out at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so forth and so on. I know all about the Bowery
Boys.
Right.
As I said, 10 years ago when I was working with them, they were still lining up to see Bowery Boys films.
Right. But these, they did finally stop making them, right?
Well, they also stopped radio and vaudeville. That doesn't mean that at the time they were making...
What? Radio has been stopped?
No. This kind of radio.
Oh, I see. Gee, you frightened me.
Well, but the point is these people are so... They don't know what they're doing. And anyway, they don't make a good Bowery Boys picture. Now, I know a little bit about this because in one of these phony Bowery Boys pictures that they made under a different name, I played the fat kid with a gang. I wrote the script. And
the fat kid with the what?
The fat kid with the gang of the dead-end kids, you know, like the dead-end kids. You know, they had, you know,
how
in
long
this gang, they had a fat kid, and I was it.
You were a fat kid in a dead-end, a Bowery Boys film?
In a Bowery Boys imitation, right?
Imitation.
He's using it in a generic sense.
Right.
That's a good word.
Thank you. I'll try to use it again.
Like Vic Trola.
That's right. You know, there's a gal in town here who's been doing a great job, too, and instead of using, she's using Super 8-2. Mm. Instead of using it in the regular fashion, the camera, everything is shot, that the camera is held in a horizontal position, and also it is projected that way with the projector. And now I have not seen her. Their name is Edna Feistel.
They did that at Expo 67. That's the big thing at Expo, was the
I didn't know
the frame that way, like Labyrinth. Did you see that?
No.
Same thing. Well, Edna Feistel has been doing this, and John Clark, our announcer, was telling me a couple of days ago they've asked him to participate in a part, but unfortunately, because of his commitments with commercials and, you know, doing shows and also doing news and all, he does not have the time. And we're talking with Jim Harmon. Jim's responsible for a new book titled The Great Radio Heroes. And, you know, if you can remember when you had the Stromberg Carlson or the Atwater Kent, or the Crosley with the WD-11 tube in it, and you'll certainly remember some of the great radio shows, such as Jack Armstrong, Tom Mix, I Love a Mystery, First Nighter, Inner Sanctum, Ma Perkins, and Jim Harmon, who was, you know, an expert in this field. He has put together a book for AA that I think is just great. You'll get a big charge out of it. We hope you have a chance to get a copy. And speaking of great books, the title of Jim Harmon's is The Great Radio Heroes. There's another great book titled The Great Merchants. And Leonard Sloan is responsible for that, financial reporter for the New York Times. Sanford Teller is a public relations consultant. And Judy was with us, Mrs. Big T, Judy Teller. And Judy returned back to the estate. And I want to tell you something. We were talking with Ambrose, who was their chauffeur, and he was waiting downstairs, and he said it was one of the coldest nights we've had this year, and Ambrose took Judy back to the estate in Greenwich. And wherever you are, Ambrose, you'll possibly be driving back soon to pick up Sandy. He's a delightful guy. How long has he been with you?
With the family.
Yeah,
you
know, well, he's actually with the Silers first.
Yeah, about 8 years. We'll be able to drop you up uptown on the west side near the you know, on the way in.
Well, you don't have to take me all the way over to Riverside Diving, drop me off there.
Well, okay. With the crime, you know, seriously, the crime these days, the muggings and all. Like I was reading the other day, so many people have been getting attacked and all. We'll take you uptown.
Right up to the
fine.
Okay. Let's get back with our guest, Sandy. Oh, read that telegram, please.
Yeah, here's a telegram. It's to Long John Neville, Care All Night Show, WNBC, New York. Pro announcer. Nearly blind. Am taping enchanting show. Early radio, please remember Vic and Sade. And it's signed Harry P. Gage, who's actually right now at the right living here at a hotel in, which I'd rather not name, in Midtown Manhattan. But Mr. Gage, evidently, is a professional announcer, and he's enjoying the show.
Well, Vic and Sade, of course. Vic and Sade, of course, was one of the great comedy programs of radio, and it was so much a favorite of so many people that I sort of dragged it in by the left ear into the book.
Uh-huh.
I included it in the soap opera chapter because it was, to some extent, a soap opera. It was on a soap opera time period, and it was, well, there was a storyline that was continued from day to day, although basically the program was a comedy. And it was just a slight exaggeration of the way people in the Midwest really are. And if you don't think people in the Midwest and small towns in the Midwest are really this way, you've never lived in one.
Sade. And, of course, that was short for Sadie.
Well, Sadie is certainly a name that's very big in New York City, too, you know.
Well, more so than the Midwest.
I would imagine, well, like Golda or things of that. There are names that are, you know, bigger in New York.
Well.
And L.A. and Miami Beach, you know.
Hollywood.
Right. No, I, you know, I have a feeling, and I got to interrupt one second, Jim. You have 3 or 4 times tonight, I think, made allusions to that particular part of the country that do not seem to be flattering.
I see.
Okay.
I could make references to the whole country that aren't flattering.
All right. You're working for the CBC now, I see.
That's true. Well,
and you didn't get up,
basis.
And you did not get up to Expo 67.
No, they didn't pay my way up there.
Well, I went up there with a couple of friends 2 weeks before it closed, and one of the great hits, as far as we were concerned, and as far as many of the people we talked to up there, was the American Pavilion, the U.S. Pavilion. And actually, this ties in with your book, because unlike the Soviet Pavilion, which was nothing more than a massive display of massive machinery, things such as not just models, but the full full-scale or working models of machines that would dig out coal or oil rigs or electronics equipment, not consumer stuff, but heavy machinery. It was a very boring exhibit, you know, unless you were interested in that particular area. But the American Pavilion...
You said a thing about tractors.
Yes, if you have any, if there are, you know, if tractors get you excited, you're in the right place. But the American Pavilion, they had great old photographs of old movie stars, bit players as well as the big stars, and then they had these rear projection continuous run motion picture equipment set up. And you would see, for example, they had one section, The Great Comedy, and they had a couple of scenes from W.C. Fields movies running.
It's
for
a good
about
name, The Great Comedy.
Such as The Great Merchant.
Great Radio Hero.
And The Great Radio Hero. And then they had love scenes, ranging back with John Gilbert and Greta Garbo and up to the present. And
the great love scenes.
The great musicals of all time. They had up to My Fair Lady. And this was a very low-key kind of thing. They also had sort of a quiz. They had about 100 or maybe 125 cardboard images, actually photographs on heavy cardboard revolving, of famous character players. And these are, you know, here you're looking at 100 people that you've seen 100 times and you don't know anybody's name.
There's a new book out, and I wish I could think of the name.
Yeah. About who?
I think it's called Who Was That?
That's right.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
All these famous, and they've had a teaser ad campaign in some of the papers showing different ones.
Well, I feel at a disadvantage tonight, and I guess Leonard does too, because I know Leonard and I discussed a number of occasions our interest in the old days of radio. And most of the people that we know, that you would ask them who was on the radio, who was Captain Midnight's arch enemy, and they wouldn't know. And you would ask, well, if you would tell them, well, it's Ivan Shark, and then they would say, well, that's great. And then you would say, who was Ivan Shark's daughter? Who's that?
Fury.
Now, few people knew that. Now, I think we'd have a tough time.
Yeah, but you know, one of the things we do at our parties, because we didn't know about this identity drink, was to sometimes about 1 o'clock in the morning start joking around about old time radio. Usually, I would bring up the subject since it happens to be my thing, and it always is a great thing. I mean, most everyone likes it. I can just think of one gal who got irritated when her husband kept participating in this. He said, you know, who was and who did this, and then she'd say, didn't you do anything else but listen to the radio when you were a kid? But
well, we did that the other night. We were out with some radio and TV people with another...
Well, they're pros. I mean, but it's fun to do
with
civilians.
No, even they. You see, these people, friends of mine, one of them is a director, works in films and TV, and his fiancée and some other people. And they also asked that question of me, didn't you do any homework, or didn't you do anything else? And I was able to do my homework while listening to Tom Mix. I had no problems with
that. Oh, sure, and it was just part of the thing. And really, you know, it just brings back memories and usually makes for a lot of fun.
Who said, all right, let's
who was Mr. First Nighter?
No, you asked that before. You know you're not going to stump Jim on that.
I wouldn't expect to stump Jim on anything. Well, it was you, Sandy, though.
Well,
I can't answer.
I'll ask better questions about journalism.
You know, Jim, you mentioned a point before, just to change something for a moment, where I think you said early in the program about a certain date, and you said, well, I'm not sure. You know, I wrote it, but I'm not sure of a date. And I admired you for saying that, because people come up to me constantly, you know, and say, when was Macy's founded, you know, and I might not have the date on the tip of my tongue, whereas it's in the book.
What book?
I don't...
The Great Merchant. He's not going to say, oh, never mind. He's going to say The Great
Merchant. M-E-R-C-H-A-N-T-Z-S-S.
Something like that.
I don't think that any author remembers everything that's in his book.
No, you look at
it. Can't be expected to.
No,
even if you try to, you know, refresh your memory before you come on a program such as this or with an interview with a newspaper man or a magazine writer. And sometimes people say, gee, you know... did this guy really write the book, or how come he can't remember that, you know, that it was in 1947? He might think it's 1946, and here it is in his book.
No, I think that...
It's unfair to ask that of an author.
It's unfair.
That's what I'm trying to say.
It's unfair to ask... that's why we never ask you any questions about The Great Merchants. It would be embarrassing. If you have to recite hours and hours of the great stories of the Hudson Company and... was it J.L. Hudson?
J.L. Hudson.
Or R.H. Macy. I had a couple of quick questions to ask you about some of the shows, Jim. Now, you take The Shadow, Lamont Cranston. Here, and to me, this is a perfect example of what I was trying to get to before about the importance of having to visualize what was happening. The Shadow just can't make it on TV.
I agree with you.
You see, I watched The Invisible Man from time to time with Claude Rains. You know, it doesn't happen.
There are some shadow movies that occasionally play on television.
But, well, they are grade C movies.
They're B, Hollywood B movies.
Were these
right?
The serials of are they? Saturday afternoon.
There was a shadow movie serial in which Victor Jory played the shadow. But as far as I know, that doesn't appear on television. These are a series of B movies. Most of them are featuring that great star, Kane Richmond, who is these days, who's a great merchant. He sells women's lingerie as a, you know, an executive level in Hollywood. But they're pretty, you know, they're pretty low grade stuff, and they certainly, you know, they aren't nearly as memorable as the radio program.
There's one little chapter, not a little chapter, but you have three different chapters. numbers 1, 2, and 3, and it's from the studios of WXYZ, where they originated the Lone Ranger and the Green Hornet and Sergeant Preston of the Yukon.
I don't know why publishers do anything. I guess they decided that section was too long to be one chapter.
Oh, no, I'm not so, criticizing it.
Yeah, but the sections on Sergeant Preston and the Green Hornet are a lot shorter than the one on the Lone Ranger.
Well, there's one in your episode here on the on Sergeant Preston and Yukon King, his fantastic dog. You discuss the scene. Let's see, where is it here? Oh, yes. Sergeant Preston was allowed a stirring climax. Let's see. King had carried through another of his innumerable messages for help, and Sergeant Preston was trapped at a trading post under attack by Indians. As soon as King arrived at Northwest Mounted Police Headquarters with a message, Preston's superior, the inspector, dispatched a troop of Mounties and men of the Canadian Field Force to the site of the uprising. Now, you keep on talking. At the end of the day, the old inspector and the dog heard the sound, and moving out through the trees and riding four abreast, the Mounties came, scarlet tunics ablaze in the setting sun. Even the horses held their heads high, sharing in the glory of victory, and in the lead astride his horse, Blackie, rode Sergeant Preston. This whole bit, we're running possibly 15 minutes, is in the Longines Symphonette collection, Jack Benny Presents the Golden Memory of Radio.
I know it is. It originally appeared on a single record. It was available both in 78 and 45, and you could buy it in the store for $1, and the Quaker Oats people also had a premium offer that you could send in I don't know, a box top and a quarter.
Right.
I
yes,
think.
There were two records, Old Time Radio 1 and Old Time Radio 2.
No, this is I'm talking about something way back.
Oh.
This was when this show was on the air, and it was a premium. I know what you're talking about. You're talking about the Ralston record.
Yeah.
But this was when the program was on the air, and it was a premium, just like the little rings and stuff that you used to get. And they have reissued that one section of that.
It comes across
record.
Now, though. You know, it really is. It's camp. When you hear this thing, you know, and
it's stereo. Yeah.
And what is that? Like you I think you quoted in your book the last line. The Yukon is saved. For the crown,
the Yukon still belongs to the crown.
Yeah, that's
well done. Yes, this case is closed. Who played Yukon King's Yukon King, rather?
Well, the WXYZ sound effects department. I don't know. I suppose a variety of sound effects men sounded those immortal barks from time to time.
But it wasn't a dog that they had recorded.
But you know, Lassie. There was a Lassie radio program, and Lassie actually did the barks and growls. Live, as it were, but that's the only case I know of a dog actually being played by a dog on the air.
We mentioned one little thing. We mentioned Fran Stryker earlier in the beginning of the program, and in your book, you discuss the kind of pay he got, and the kind of pay most people in radio got at that time.
The early 30s.
Probably seemed like a fortune to John today, you know, just knowing what he's making and all. They got $12.50 a week, and they only had to work 5 days a week.
Well, we already know that John thinks $750,000 a year is just barely a living wage, so I think we know how much money he must be making.
You're right about John. John is making that type of money.
That's what I'm saying. You take Fran,
there's no gamble.
No gamble. The Lone Ranger, you know, you talk about the Fran Stryker, who wrote The Lone Ranger.
May I just say this to you? Let me just interrupt you for a moment. You're telling me that people in 30 made $12 a week.
$12.50.
May I tell you that you can pick up one of our trade journals and you will find that there are jobs available in smaller towns with 250-watt stations, 500-watt stations, where a fella will go to work there today and no problem getting a man for $40 and $50 a week, which is a lot less than $12 was in 1930. And I would, if I were a young man today, and if I were just starting in this business, and, you know, it's kind of a tough chance to walk into NBC or to WR, you know, and say, look, I'd, you know, like to sit in and I have the time to spare and to grab that job. That's only a freak will get that break, and I speak of myself that way. But if I were a young man and I really wanted to get into this business, I certainly would be happy if my dad left me enough money to take care of myself to work for free for 4 or 5 months in a radio station to learn and to experiment where I could do this on a station, a 250 or a 500-watt station. And if the boss would like to have me during my spare time to brush out his car, to vacuum out his car, and maybe it was a warm day to Simonize it, I'd be down there doing it to get the experience. So I don't think that $12 was a small amount of money back in 1930.
Well, they talked here.
Some of the people weren't getting $12. They were making like $3 and $4 a week. It was the contract players that got $12.50. The guys that freelanced, and worked whenever they had an opening for a spare voice, you know. Hey, who was that masked man? That's all they said. They got $3 a week, $4. Of course, they couldn't live on it. They had to do something else. They sold insurance, or I don't know. But
you say here in the year 1939, Fran Stryker was working 14 hours a day, 7 days a week. He wrote 156 Lone Ranger scripts, plus 156 scripts for the other shows on WXYZ, plus 365 daily comic strips of The Lone Ranger, plus 12 juvenile novels of The Lone Ranger, and finally he edited and supervised 30 episodes of two different Lone Ranger serials and movies, and they paid him $200 a week.
Yeah, well,
but that isn't that bad, then, you know, from what John was.
Well, what John was saying, you know. Yeah, but
did you ever hear of a fellow by the name of Robert Monroe?
I can't recall.
Well, Robert Monroe at one time was vice president of Mutual Network, and before that he wrote Steel. What's the Steel show?
John Steele?
High Adventure and Rocky Garden. Those are only a couple. I know a lot of other. Radio Novels was a syndicated thing that I had a minor interest in, too, when Bob Monroe was really starting to move. Now, Bob Monroe, I think, was great. Bob Monroe, and these are live shows we're talking about, not recording. You know, no one ever heard of tape, except tape was something that was made by Johnson & Johnson. It was called a piece of tape.
Yeah. Yeah, you wrapped around your wrist.
That's right. That was the only reason you had any tape. But Bob Monroe, the actors would be there, like two or three microphones, and in the back was Jack Keane. You remember Jack Keane? Would be on a sound truck over at WOR, and Schaefer was on a sound truck. And these actors standing around groups around the microphones, and they're doing this about 15 minutes in the show, and there's Bob Monroe typing the rest of the script for a network show. This is true.
I've heard similar stories, but I...
Because I saw this. I was not in radio myself at the time.
Yeah.
But I saw this with my own eyes, and to me it was just remarkable.
And of course, you know, sometimes these people didn't get those scripts done at all.
And ad-lib.
And the actors would have to ad-lib.
That's right.
And there's one famous story it's not in the book, but this fellow told me that they were doing a program called Black and Blue Detectives, and it was a West Coast network. You know, they had a regional West Coast network. And they didn't have the script on time, and these two detectives were standing around, you know, and there was supposed to be a murdered woman on the floor there, her body all stretched out on the floor, and they had to ad-lib for 15 minutes. And, you know, some people, their conversation is different than other people. And one of these fellows... he couldn't say two words without it being blue or off color. And so here he was ad-libbing for 15 minutes about this scantily clad body of this murdered woman here. And that was the last time that anybody ever ad-libbed on a dramatic program on that station. If they didn't have the script, they just played
didn't
a record. Yeah.
You know, we were talking about that Sergeant Preston episode. There was another thing I remember on one of the records that struck me.
On the Longines set that Long John Neville is offering.
Longines Symphonettes.
And this was the last broadcast of Ma Perkins.
Right.
And you referred to that also. And, you know, it starts off in one of these typical scenes, the theory, you know, God's in his heaven, all right with the world. And then at the end, Virginia Payne comes on. I believe she died not too long ago, if I'm not mistaken.
I don't think so.
I think she's still around.
Well,
but
I hope so. But I just sort of had in the back of my mind that I saw something about that. But in any event, she got on the air, and she said, this is the last episode of Ma Perkins after, what was it, 2,700, something of that.
7,000 broadcasts.
7,000, was it? Yeah. These were the actors who played the parts, you know, and she said, so-and-so played Faye for 3 years, and then someone else, and so-and-so played Evie, and then she says that, and I played Ma Perkins for all the years that it was on the air.
Right.
And to me, this was, you know, just sort of a real sentimental note above all the superficial ones.
Yes.
Gentlemen, let's take a break. Anybody knows the type that is?
It looks like something from the 1920s.
It's called Broadway type.
Is that it?
That's right. That is Broadway type, and I think that first came out, it wasn't in the 1920s, about 1930 or 1931. This was kind of the in thing.
I see it on a lot of buildings in Hollywood, and it kind of looks dated, so it's, well, 1930 or 31 is an appropriate style of type.
It's probably chosen, I suppose, intentionally.
It was called Broadway.
They're darned clever that way.
Broadway type. Yeah. The jacket is by Saul Lambert, and the typography by Catherine Hopkins of Jim Harmon's book. Sandy?
One of the great things on the old premiums you used to get for like nothing or a dime or 20 cents. Now,
self-liquidating.
Well, they were so great. Yeah, they were, but they were so great, you know, for a kid who didn't know anything other than this is the kind of thing that would, as you point out, that Tom Mix would use to get out of a scrape, or that possibly Captain Midnight, the decoder.
The decoders were the greatest.
Well, that had utilitarian value. But the one thing that I, you know, I wish I had kept some of these, like you, like I wish I'd kept comic books, but the one thing that I always remember is the atomic scope ring that you would look in and see atomic reactions take place in the dark.
That was from the Lone Ranger.
Now, what was the Lone Ranger doing with an atomic ring? What was there? Oh, you have some of the things there.
I just happen to have
Captain
Midnight decoder.
Len, would you describe that to Captain Midnight decoder?
Well, it looks like a badge. Actually, it is a badge that you wear with a pin to pin onto your shirt, I guess. And it has all the in a circle. It has all the letters of the alphabet.
How do you know?
I'm looking at them.
You've already ascertained that it has 27 letters.
And around the outside, it says Secret Squadron, Captain Midnight.
And is it tarnished?
And inside, there's an inner ring with the various numbers, excuse me.
It's in good shape.
And this ring rotates so that I suppose you would turn the numbers as you were given the numbers according to the code to get your right message.
Well, they give you a master code, like, you know, M1, so you turn the dial till it was under, you know, M,
mm-hmm.
And then you let it set that way, and then you checked all the numbers off, and then of course you could, I don't know the mathematics involved, how many combinations that is, but it's a lot.
Jim, where do you get that from?
That's just one that I saved. I have bought a few on occasions.
It says 1946 at the bottom, Jim. I guess
that must
remember,
mean,
did you keep it from that?
Yeah. Most of the stuff like that, I just kept.
What is that? What do you have that ring in your hand?
Well, I. These things are a little slow for radio, you know, hold them up the mic, but.
Wait a minute. Are you going to blow a whistle of some sort?
I'm going to blow a whistle, and I'm going to tear the heart out of those engineers.
There's a man out there who's getting ready for that.
Yeah, okay. Now, that is a genuine Tom Mix slide whistle ring.
You could tell by the sound.
Yeah,
is that a bullet-shaped whistle on top of the ring?
Well, more or less.
I can't see from here.
The only trouble being in here any minute, because, you know, that's causing.
What else do you have there?
Well, this is a Tom Mix signal arrowhead. It's got some whistles on it, too. It's got some whistles on it, too. How about that?
You play it beautifully, Jim.
That's a plastic arrowhead about 4 inches long and about...
Well, it's not quite that.
Three and a half.
About three and a half.
And about two and a half.
Two and a half, yeah. Right.
It's an arrowhead and it's got a compass, I believe, too.
There is another Tom Mix arrowhead that has a compass. This is a siren, which, you know, sounds like a siren, except it's kind of rusted and won't work anymore.
And you have a magnifying glass built into the point of the arrow.
Yes, it's got a magnifying glass, and it's not only got a magnifying glass, I want you to know, it's got a smallifying glass, in case you need to make anything smaller. That's what they call it. You want a technical name, it's a reduction lens. But
what do they charge for that?
I think it was 10 cents in a box top.
And, of course, as you point out, I think I recall those days that you would wait for those weeks to pass by.
Yes, they'd always
postman
say...
never showed up with that.
They would always say, send in your name and address, your box top and your dime, and then, almost by return mail...
Yes, that's right.
But that wasn't an accurate description.
It's the longest return mail you could think of.
I might say that this rather... No, I mean, it's still shiny and bright and everything.
The badge. The decoder badge.
Captain Midnight decoder badge. It cost absolutely nothing. All you had to do, well, I mean, it cost no cash. All you had to do is send in your seal, the inner seal from a jar of Ovaltine. And they sent you that Captain Midnight badge, and they also sent you a Captain Midnight secret manual such as this. They don't match, unfortunately. They're not a matched set, but... That's for another photograph, but you got those two items and maybe something else like a picture of Captain Midnight or something. It's all free, absolutely. What does self-liquidating mean? I really don't know, and I think that might be interesting if you're in the advertising business to explain what a self-liquidating premium is.
Compressed under a pressure of 5,000 pounds per square inch, it would become a liquid matter. And this in itself would cause no problems with the Internal Revenue Service.
I see.
The cost of the premium, actually, what the Captain Midnight...
The 10 cents that you send in is enough to pay for the premium.
Yeah, but the Captain Midnight badge cannot be a self-liquidating premium.
Because it costs no cash at all.
The idea is so that you get the value of the promotion of the premium for nothing. So it's strictly free advertising.
Yeah, if the dime or 20 cents
covers... If the dime were enough.
Covers
and that's supposed to cover... the cost plus the cost of the shipping and mailing and the promotion and so on.
I don't see how it could, because as I remember, the postage is always something like 4 cents. And well, of course, I don't know anything about manufacturing. Maybe you could make something like that for a fraction of a cent, you suppose, back in those days.
1946. I suppose it wouldn't be too much.
Yeah.
Wouldn't be too much even today.
Yeah.
What else do you have? You have a little booklet there that we haven't seen yet.
Yes. Well, I'll just tell you what this is, and I don't care what you want to say about it, but this is what it is. This is an instruction manual that tells you how to use the Little Orphan Annie cockpit.
This is a little plane that they had going at the time.
Well, this was a mock-up of a airplane.
Mm-hmm.
The cockpit, and
the pilot's controls and all.
Yeah, it had everything. It had the rudders, and it told you how to use the joystick and get the plane set up to take off. There's all sorts of technical information.
Yeah, well, that's a good booklet. Can I see the other, the Captain Midnight? Is that newer?
It has
the color is different than that.
It has the
lithography.
It tells you how to use the elevators and the... What does this word mean? Ailerons? I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's good enough. Yeah. I think that the Captain Midnight badge is possibly the most exciting of the premiums, because the others, you were a kid, possibly you didn't know how to read.
Can I read this? They asked me to do this on another show.
Captain Midnight.
Yes, the Captain Midnight.
What's that?
And I do it very well. I do it exceedingly well.
I'm sure
it sounds like one of the old commercials. Organize your own secret squadron, Flight Wing. Get your SS member friends together regularly.
Your what?
Your
SS.
Secret Squadron. What year was this, Jim?
Yeah, that's in the book, too. That SS was a rather unfortunate reference. On television, they changed it to SQ. But anyway, get your Secret Squadron member friends together regularly. Work out your own code practice sessions to see who can take down Captain Midnight's code messages fastest, most accurately, and most neatly.
Well, competition there.
You never interrupt the commercials. I mean, that's
not a commercial.
They don't when I'm doing it. No.
that's real.
That shows seniority, I guess. Well, okay. So much for my big chance as a radio announcer.
Well, here's a telegram that comes in from Brooklyn, New York, from Theodora Pearson. Remember Jimmy Scribner, who did a skit and did all the voices himself?
Yeah,
what's that all about?
Johnson family. It was, like Amos and Andy, and Jimmy Scribner did all the voices of the Johnson family. The women, he did women, the elder women and the young women, and he did the little kids and the old men and the young men and the neighbors. He did all of them, and he actually sounded like a whole crowd of people. He was excellent.
You mentioned in the book the people like Santos Ortega and some of the
great
actors.
The man of all voices.
Yeah, how many voices... How many parts do you like a guy like Santos Ortega?
What a distinctive voice. Beautiful voice.
A great name, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How many parts could he play in one?
Irish fellow.
Possibly. In one half-hour episode, he could do three or four voices, for example.
Oh, sure. He could do any dialect you ever thought of, and he could play a young man or an old man.
You know, we spoke before about some of the Negro stereotypes that were on radio. A couple came to my mind. One, I recall, of course, was Beulah, which was a famous one.
Right.
There's another one, perhaps you can recall the name. This was, I think, about the most stereotyped program that I have ever heard. It was a Negro situation comedy, and the theme song was Funiculi Funicula.
Well, that was the theme song of Lorenzo Jones, but he wasn't a Negro.
Yeah, right. No, I know that. No, and I know Lorenzo Jones I believe it was Finicula, Finicula. I might be wrong. Am I bringing any...
Well, I mean, tell me something else.
It was it was sort of a family situations, people sort of in almost a Negro ghetto, but, you know, it wasn't a ghetto situation. It was just all the characters were Negro, and then they were living in their own little world, and all the stereotypes with the high-pitched voices, and then the land sakes and Lordy B and
I wonder if you're not talking about the program we just mentioned, the Johnson family.
You mean the president? You're not talking about that.
That was not a
different kind of.
That was not a Negro family.
No, that accent shouldn't throw you off. That, you know, I mean, it's just, you know, everybody from the South and Texas, they talk like that.
I rather like some of the Southern accents, like Curly Bradley had a Southern.
Well,
Southwestern, like.
I wish Curly Bradley. More people ask me whatever happened to Curly Bradley, because they know where the other people are. They're no longer with us, or they're in television and so forth. But I would like to know myself, since he was one of my favorites on the radio. And people ask me today, I was over at CBS, and somebody asked me where Curly Bradley... I said a dirty word, didn't I? I'm sorry.
What?
But, I mentioned another network.
Oh!
Yeah. But anyway...
As long as we're tops, we mention the others.
Okay. That's... Shows heart. But anyway, I'd like to know where Curly Bradley's at. And all these people are sending in telegrams. If anybody knows the current whereabouts of Curly Bradley, why don't they call in?
But they can't call in.
Telegram.
Yeah.
Richard Lamparsky's book, Whatever Happened To, possibly.
He did a good book.
Yeah, he
Dick
may
did
have
a good
that,
book.
Not some of these characters
I've
are
heard about that book, but I haven't had a chance to read it.
Good book, yeah. You
what was the opening of Mr. District Attorney?
And it shall be my duty as district attorney not only to prosecute all those charged with crimes perpetrated within this county, but to defend with equal vigor the rights and privileges of all its citizens.
Is that right, John? John used to do it. Well, the DA's like,
you want the other. Mr. District Attorney, champion of the people, guardian of our fundamental rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Just
brought to you by the makers of, well,
you
other
left
products.
Defender of truth.
I'm sorry. I mean, nobody's perfect.
True.
No.
Well, I mean,
you haven't been around me that long.
Yes.
I know it. I know. You can see it coming, you know.
What about some of the theme songs? Wasn't there also a close identification of theme songs with shows, whereas possibly we didn't know the names, we could, if we were to hear the themes, we would recognize so many of them as themes, and we would recognize the show that they were from.
Well, if anybody can sing or hum, they could do that part of it. I can't carry a tune myself, so I know the names of these songs. The Shadows theme song was Omphale's Spinning Wheel.
Jack Benny was Love and Bloom.
Right. Lone Ranger. Well, the Lone Ranger used a lot of things. The theme.
Of course, the William Tell Overture.
William Tell Overture, and they also used, The Prelude by Liz. That was the middle theme. They always. That was.
Yeah, that's right. Dun, 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 dun.
The curtain falls.
Yeah, I'm glad you got a job writing, man, really.
I always liked the middle break on the Lone Ranger. It showed such class. They say, the curtain falls on Act One of our Lone Ranger drama. Please permit us to pause for just a few moments for this message of interest and importance. Mm-hmm. And then a commercial.
That's right. Yeah.
The Love for Three Oranges, that was the FBI in Peace and War.
L-A-V-A, L-A-V-A. You can get son of a bill.
We have another telegram here. A gentleman by the name of D.L. Brush, signed Connecticut Security, gives us a phone number. He says, Sidney Walton, old-time WOR, suggests a personal contact regarding old-time radio. Phone collect any hour. Well, I don't know what this is about, and
Sidney Walton is, of course, an announcer, or was an announcer.
Oh, yeah.
Did many shows.
Yes, very, very big name.
But we don't handle our shows that way, and the contract that I have with WNBC does not permit me to just call people at random. They call me on Plaza 7-886-6745-28 any night, that is five nights a week, or if they want to write a letter, and then in turn it goes through our program department. Howard Baer and John Powers and Frank Fisher, who sit and determine the merits of the idea.
Has that IBM thing been set up yet, where that'll be going through?
No,
the...
but the funny part of it is it was so noisy in my office today, and dust and all around, because they're drilling the hole.
Installation.
It isn't as big as I thought it would be.
It'll be about
20, 22 feet in length.
Mm-hmm.
And about 9 feet high. And actually, the first programming is going to be done by Frank Fisher, our night supervisor. And he has planned a complete programming idea. And from that point on, as I get, and I may be wrong, they put in, that's possibly not the correct terminology to use, but they feed into the computer.
Input.
Yeah. The show idea.
Yeah.
That is in a maximum of 3 words. In other words, if it would be the sex life after 40, they wouldn't do that. They would say sex after 40.
Right.
Three words.
Right.
Condensed down to 3 words. Then, not the names of the people, but their backgrounds, like psychologist, psychiatrist,
journalist,
taxi cab driver, you know, things like that. And this is fed in. Now a reply comes out. Fair, medium, great. And then in turn, the last thing is on a rather small machine. I guess you call it a computer. I was absolutely amazed. It didn't amaze Frank Fisher, because he's been so deeply involved in having been one of the designers that has not received the applause that he should for some of the designs. But there's sort of a miniature one where the names are put in, and I don't approve of this myself, but nevertheless it might have some merit, the names and the birth dates, not necessarily the year, and astrologically it is determined. In other words, let us say if we had four psychics, we only need one. Well, we put the four names in with their birth dates, plus my birth date, the birth date of our announcer, John Clark, and our director, Howard Baer, and it tells you which one of the psychologists to use, which one of the taxi cab drivers, whether he should be an owner driver or work for a fleet. And this is the way the programs will be done. But that won't be for another 6-8 weeks from now.
That much longer.
Yeah, well, because the installation is absolutely fabulous.
What happens during a power? Let's hope we don't have another power failure.
That's about power.
Yeah.
There are three types of current they can use. They can use AC current, DC current, or river current. So in other words, no matter what may happen, whether there's a power failure or not...
You've got the Hudson River there all the time.
Well, yes, it's close by.
Incredible.
And there is a line that creates another magnetic field that is attached to the base down at 42nd Street. They couldn't do it on 49th Street. Why? I don't know, I guess. You know, some genius thought... No, I shouldn't be critical because I don't know what I'm talking about there. But on 42nd Street, they have this small piece of equipment that is submerged into the Hudson River.
Right.
And if there's a failure of the AC current or the DC current, we always have Hudson River current, so that the device will continue to function. Right now, speaking of...
4 p.m.
left, unfortunately. I would like to take just a moment before we wrap it up to remind our listeners that the book is titled The Great Radio Heroes. Not because Jim Harmon is here, because we've talked about it a couple of times before he arrived in New York. The book is very, very interesting. I had commented earlier, certainly if you're on the wrong side of 40, you'll remember many, many of these things. And, you know, if you're in your 20s...
Which side is the wrong side, John?
My side. My side. Which is 41. What side would you think would be the wrong side, before or after 40?
Well, normally it's referred to as the after 40, but I thought that I've heard it sometimes in some sort of a facetious way that...
it's the good sign, you mean?
You know, life begins
starts
at 40
and
all
that.
Yeah.
No, I think I originated the line, the wrong side of 40, but certainly life begins after 40 was... Who wrote that?
Walter something.
Yeah, Walter. Oh, yes? Thank you. From Portland, Maine, Chris Randall. Listening in Portland. Listening in Portland, Maine. These computers are not working too well, Frank, will you? I think we're on River Current right now.
Me, Stars, and you, Jane.
That's right. Very interesting show, but I must go on the air myself very early this morning. And I would like to know about Long John's offer you were talking about. Also about Soundmen. How about Bob Prescott and announcer Fred Foy? Don't know if I'll be awake when you give info. Would appreciate Long John's offer by return mail to above address. Chris Randall, 135 Chadwick Street, Portland, Maine. I don't know what offer is he talking about.
I think the record album.
Oh, well, maybe so.
You could send him the labels, too.
Yeah, maybe that's it. Well, get a copy of The Great Radio Heroes for one thing, Chris, and you'll enjoy it, learning about what was happening in radio.
Fred Foy was the announcer on The Lone Ranger.
Really?
Yes, uh-huh. He was the one.
We have a great announcer here, Fred Facy, who's with us. I mean, he's a very young man, though. Very young man.
I see.
Judy Teller has been with us. That's Mrs. Big T. Sanford Teller. That's Big T. Leonard Sloan, financial reporter for the New York Times and author of the book, The Great Merchants. And Jim Harmon, author of The Great Radio Heroes. Speaking of great people, I think we could take a moment to remind our listeners that John Powers is our great engineer. And our great director is, I can't think of that kid's name.
Marconi.
Howard Thayer.